Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC. Who's who? Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Fishing and Arisia and Woody Winks.
Hey, hey, hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC. Who's who?
Hello, and welcome to the Justice League International Bwahaha podcast.
And also, Who's Who, the definitive podcast of the DC Universe.
Both proud members of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm one of your hosts, the Irredeemable Shag, and along with me is my Who's Who podcast co-host and previous guest on the JLI podcast, the esteemed Rob Kelly. Welcome back to the embassy, Rob. How you doing, buddy?
Is this the part where you want me to tell that story about how I inked that one panel on the JLI annual, or are we doing that later?
I think you've told that story four or five times now on the JLI podcast. That's why I keep having you come back. So
you know I went to the Joe Kubert school, right? They're all familiar with that.
First time I'm hearing this information. You're all clear on that one, kid. You don't have to do that again. Folks, this is going to be another of our flashback episodes for the Who's Who podcast, where we play clips of old episodes around a specific subject. You know, in the past, we've done episodes on the JLA, we've done Aquaman, Wonder Woman, the Teen Titans, all those were flashback episodes. Today, we'll be playing clips from old Who's Who episodes featuring characters from the various Justice League International comics. Hence why this is both a Who's Who episode and a JLI podcast episode. I mean, really, it's a JLI podcast episode. Let's not kid ourselves. We're just stealing Who's Who content.
And if you've never listened to the Who's Who podcast, shame on you, by the way. It's a show that Shag and I started back in 2012. The mission was to cover every single issue of Who's Who one page at a time. It took 11 years, but we did it.
And that's where Frank writes in the comment, you haven't done Impact yet.
The final episode. That's right. The fun.
It is not the final episode. Don't do that. You're going to get Frank an aneurysm. For this episode, folks.
Oh, that's a win-win.
Oh, that's terrible. Oh, man. So for this episode, so we picked up from a variety of Who's Who sources. Now, Rob and I, the current show we're doing for Who's Who is called Who's Who Review, where we're revisiting the original Who's Who issues. So that what I did for this, all the selections for today are going to come from subsequent editions. So nothing from the original Who's Who, because I don't want to do anything we're covering already. So they're all subsequent editions. So we're talking Update 87, 88, the loose leaf, stuff like that. And really, I mean, the JLI didn't get started until 1987 anyway, right? So that's why we're focusing on Who's Who Update 87 and forward. And frankly, the vast majority of these are coming from the Loose Leaf edition. About 80% of them are, really, because that's when that was the most popular era of the JLI.
That means that some of these clips go back as far as 2015, so that's 9 years ago. Just know that with older clips may come some audio quality issues and opinions that evolve over time.
And I mean, that's very true, because, you know, again, we're starting with Update 87, and that was before I'd even decided to start the JLI podcast. So at that point, like, some of these entries you're going to hear, I'm not very knowledgeable about the JLI. Like, I'm just guessing on stuff. I don't really know. So listening back, I can, like, hear all the mistakes I made. So don't just cut me some slack. Understand that, folks. And as I was editing this thing together, one thing that struck me from the Who's Who podcast perspective is that we talk so much in the Who's Who entries about the character's history. And most of that is pretty much never touched on in any of the JLI comics. So if you only read the JLI comic or listen to that podcast, there's a ton about these characters you probably never even knew. So stick around, kids. You might learn something. Also, okay, so this is super cool. Very, very exciting news. I've been teasing this all week leading up to this. On this very episode, we are premiering a brand new custom Who's Who entry created by Osamu Yukinori, the son of Zoom Yukinori, who's our dear departed friend and former contributor to the Who's Who podcast. Osamu's carrying on the tradition of his father that started by designing custom Who's Who pages for entries that were missed back in the day. So in the loose leaf Who's Who, you know, back in the 90s, there was one particular, I mean, there was a few, but there's one particularly glaring omission that really bothered the JLI fans for decades, which is the American team of the JLA, they received their own Who's Who loose leaf entry. But the European team never received their own entry. Well, Osamu has corrected that error after 30 years. So at the end of this episode, we're going to cover the brand new custom Justice League Europe loose leaf edition from Who's Who, compiled by Osamu. But he's done it in the style of Bart Sears artwork, and it's astonishing. So stick around to the end of this episode. So again, everything's going to be flashback episodes, or clips, until the end when Rob and I are going to record new content for the Justice League Europe entry. So another thing, too, while I was compiling these clips, I realized that the Who's Who podcast is directly responsible for the creation of my JLI podcast. This is all true. I was listening to the clips, and I stumbled across the origin of the JLI podcast right there. I'm going to play for you right now a 30-second clip, and it's like in two parts. And the first part comes from a Who's Who episode we recorded way back in 2015. And the first one is we're covering the Gray Man entry on Who's Who Update 87. And then the second part of that clip is going to be the following episode where we're doing the feedback section that also addresses it. So it'll make sense once you hear the clip. So we'll play that now, and we'll come back in a second. And this is the part where I normally tell people where they can find out more about the character. And I'm going to put it out there, folks. Somebody needs to start, unless I'm unaware of one, a Justice League International or a podcast or blog. I mean, I can't believe there's not one out there that we know of. Heard from Jimmy McGlinchey. He said, totally agree with you on what you said in the Who's Who episode. There should be a Justice League International podcast. Yes, there should be, people. It's been more than a month since I said that, and nothing's happened. I'm disappointed in all of you. Go in the corner. Think about what you haven't done. All right, so we're back. We're 2024 now, and you can hear just how frustrated I was that there was no JLI podcast. And I guess I went all like Thanos at that point and said, fine, I'll do it myself. And I looked at the timetable of it. Just 4 weeks after that audio was recorded, I was already in pre-production for the very first episode of JLI podcast. So I guess like that night, maybe it started brewing in my head.
It was refreshing to hear you be so frustrated, but not at me for once. It was nice.
It is weird. It's rare, right? You know,
actually, it's rare. It's very rare.
I get jealous, though. I listen back to those old podcasts. I'm like, man, Shag was a lot funnier back then. I wish I was that funny now. I miss that version of Shag. Oh, well.
Me too.
I bet you I knew. I didn't even realize I was setting that up for you, and I did perfectly.
You're slowing down, Shag. You're getting older. You're slowing down.
Before Rob pisses me off any further, we should take a second to thank our sponsors, folks. This episode of the JLI podcast
and the Who's Who podcast
is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode will select a collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStockTrades library, and it's usually tied into our episode in some way, shape, or form. Rob, what'd you pick today?
All right, I wasn't trying to be super clever here because that's hard for me. So I went with the Justice League International Book 2, Around the World, trade paperback. It reprints Justice League International 18 through 25, Justice League America 26 through 30, Justice League Europe 1 through 6, and Justice League International Annual Number 1, of course, by the all-star team of DeMatteis, Giffen, and McGuire. And it features an all-new cover of our team. And I will just say, if you look at this cover, I mean, it's great. It's McGuire, but I so love Mr. Miracle and Barda hugging in the middle of the group. It's just so charming.
It is. It absolutely is. And it's a great pick. Obviously, we don't need to sell it to you folks. If you're listening to this episode, you're already a fan. So, and I also did not work hard to come up with a deep selection. I picked Who's Who Omnibus Hardcover Volume 2, specifically because in addition to the Legion of Superheroes and the updates, it collects the 16-issue loose leaf, which is where, again, 80% of these entries are going to come from. So if you've got the Omnibus Volume 2 in your hand, it is a perfect companion for what we're about to go through. So it's published by DC, a beautiful cover by Brian Bolland, full page count, 1,216 pages, full color. It's a hardcover and normally goes for $150, but you can get it for 42% off, so only $87. That is a heck of a deal. So for these and all your trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Now, this episode of the JLI podcast
and the Who's Who podcast
is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support, folks, because running the Fire and Water Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched the Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying these shows, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon. What's that, Rob?
Patreon.com/FW Podcasts.
And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. And at certain tiers, you get mentioned on your show of choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized on the JLI podcast
and the Who's Who podcast.
Our thanks go out to Bill Beer, Bruno Diaz, Christopher Lewis, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, Doug Adamson, George Van Note, John Coos, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matt Ev, Maxwell Traver, Michael Crouch, Mike Zumkowski, Roger Priebe, Rudy Castillo, Sean Ross, Superman Radio Revisited Podcast, Symbol Pending, Tim Price,
Charles Coletta, Damian Whiter, David Ace Gutierrez, Gore Tolden, Jack Dower, Jeremiah Jones Goldstein, Mike Atchison, Nathan Archer, Noah Tarnow, Tom Perrain, and Tom Panneries.
Again, folks, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW Podcast. All right. So in a second, we're going to take a podcast promo break. And when we come back, you're going to hear a ton of old clips from the Who's Who podcast featuring JLI characters.
If you want to provide feedback, please leave your comments on the Fire and Water podcast website. You can choose to leave them on either the JLI podcast entry or the Who's Who entry.
Personally, I recommend the JLI podcast, but that's just me. Folks, you're going to hear over 30 clips, something actually, I think like 35, and they're not going to be in chronological order for when the Who's Who issues were published. Instead, they're more in an order that made sense to me. And you can follow along over on our website on the image gallery for the JLI podcast. I'm going to put all the entries there so you can see them. Don't go to the image gallery under Who's Who. It's not going to be there. It's going to be under JLI. So we'll post the art for every entry. And check out, man, this thing, all these clips, we're talking about, this is a veritable Who's Who of JLI artists. This is awesome. We've got folks like Kev Maguire, Terry Austin, Ty Templeton, Adam Hughes, Bart Sears, Linda Medley, Mike McCone, Chris Sprouse, Tom Artis, Joe Phillips, just every single one of them associated with the JLI. And then there's more.
Yeah, there's some surprising non-JLI artists like Jim Aparo, Carmen Infantino, Brian Bolland, Dan Jurgens, Joe Staten, Greg LaRocque, Pat Broderick, Stephen DeStefano, and more.
It's just amazing. The artwork in these books are in these entries are just outstanding. So you're in for a real treat, folks. And a fair warning, before we get started and before y'all start rolling into the comments, because I know how you people work, I had to make some tough choices, okay? Like if a character had multiple entries, you know, like in maybe 87 and 88 and then loose leaf, whatever, I had to pick whichever one was most appropriate, right? Or I picked because Rob and I had a more interesting conversation. Also, there's some JLI characters that I decided not to include because they were members for like a super short time. And really, like their Who's Who entries were not based around the JLI at all. It was about them, you know, their history or whatever. So here's a list of characters I did not include, and you don't need to write in the comments, say, where's Dr. Light? Come on, she was around for what, an issue and a half? I also didn't pick Black Canary or Dr. Fate, Captain Marvel, Hawkman and Hawkwoman, Huntress, Light Ray, or Orion, and nor did I pick Tasmanian Devil. There's also the entries for the Justice League International Embassy staff, but we covered those on the podcast here a few years back when we did the 1989 annual, so I skipped those. And then you might want to brace yourself. Sit down, folks. This is going to come as a tremendous shock for you Justice League Europe fans, but I did not include Wonder Woman. I know. Heartbreaking. Incomplete. I get it. I'm sorry. And then, I didn't include Batman, all right? So I'm sure that's going to have people outraged. But the fact is, all of his entries are about Batman. They have nothing to do with the Justice League, at least international. So I didn't include him in this round. And now, before you really start whining about all those entries I just mentioned that we skipped, remember, you're going to get like 35 entries. So be happy with what we're giving you and don't complain.
Wow. Now, you are quite the host, Jack.
With that motivational speech out of the way, after this podcast promo break, Rob and I, from 9 years ago, will be right back. And remember, stick around to the end for the first time ever coverage of the custom Justice League Europe Who's Who entry.
And action! It's Fade Out. Hosted by film fanatic Rob Kelly and a roster of special guests, Fade Out will examine the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Up next is the kapow moment of
there
the
we go, finally.
It is Justice League. Boom! Kevin Maguire picture, which honestly, I almost wish they had just dropped the text and gave me a full 2-page spread of this picture because it's so gorgeous. This is Kevin Maguire drawing not just...
And Terry Austin,
I'm sorry. Not just drawing the Justice League International type era, but he's drawing the entire Justice League. And as it should be, up front, in the center, are the two most representative members of the Justice League, Gypsy and Creeper. It's perfect. What the huh? Creeper? What the huh? It even talks about in the entry Creeper had just joined the Justice League. No, he didn't.
That's a stretch. Yeah.
Well, clearly what happened there was he was going to join. Like Giffen and DeMatteis had planned for him to join probably, and then something changed, and so they went a different direction. Because they talk about him sort of joining just recently, around the same time they start talking about it, you know, the current Justice League and the international. Do they get into the international aspect of it? They hint at it, but they don't actually call it Justice League International in the entry. But so I think
it mentions help grant them international diplomatic status.
Yeah, and Giffen and DeMatteis have talked about this before, how they used to get plans to add characters to the series, and then by the time they got around to finally adding them, something had changed, they'd have to change direction. And I think that's one of these cases. it's just kind of funny that Creeper got the front spot right next to Superman. So beautiful drawing. Everyone is gorgeously rendered. It's one of the few chances I've gotten to see, you know, get McGuire draw Firestorm. He looks totally awesome. I dig his Aquaman.
Yep.
You know, and of course all the JLI characters, like, you know, Mr. Miracle and Guy Gardner and Captain Marvel and Booster Gold and all them look great. Vibe looks totally badass. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous picture. Now, in the text, there's absolutely no mention in the whole thing of Superman or Wonder Woman, which would be correct in post-crisis. However, Superman is in the drawing. In fact, he's the center person of the drawing.
Yep.
So it sort of suggests that Superman's still integral to the Justice League, and yet he's not mentioned at all. I don't know whether maybe they hadn't decided at that point or something. I'm not sure. And they do credit him in the little heads as Superman 2. So apparently we're still sticking from the Who's Who Volume 1, you know, designations.
And it mentions Batman 2 as well.
Yeah, good point. Yeah. And they don't even need to do that anymore because Now they've had the update with Batman. So just a beautiful piece. I could stare at this thing all day. I would love a poster of this. Now, I have some, you know, they've distributed lots of Kevin Maguire JLA, because he was famous for doing this JLA pose or Justice League pose, you know. In fact, I've got a great little poster from the Justice League source book from one of the role-playing games, and it had a poster of Maguire Justice League kind of similar to this, but this is just a beautiful one. I'd love to have this as a thing.
Yeah, no, I love this piece. I love that Maguire fits in so much characterization. Even though everybody's just standing around, like you see Hawkman, it looks like Hawkman and Hawkgirl are holding hands, but you can't quite tell. Mm-hmm. But it's very dignified. But on the other side of it, Green Arrow and Black Canary are hugging each other,
yep.
Which is really sweet. Vibe is doing his stupid badass thing that he does. The Atom is being friendly. Batman is setting off into the background. It's a wonderful. But yeah, I was pretty disappointed with the previous Justice League entry, the one by McDonald and Ray.
Oh yeah,
but this one really delivers the goods. So, and it is great to see all the characters from all the different eras because you never get to see them all together,
right?
You know, so that's really great. Although I will have to take issue with some of the text, and then it goes out of its way to take a swipe at Aquaman. It says, participation in League emergencies varied over the years as individual heroes were called away by crises of more personal natures. At one low point in the group effort, Aquaman, the only active founding member, enacted a clause in the bylaws and disbanded the Justice League. Well, thanks, guys. You really had to just get that in there.
Well, no, I think that's fair, though. I mean, it was the low point. They're not calling Justice League Detroit a low point. What they're saying is there was the war with Mars, and nobody showed up.
I know, but, you know, it just feels a little like, you know, I had to get awkward.
I think it's fair, and I think you're a little too close to the issue, perhaps, maybe on this
quite one. Possible.
Now, Rocket Red's in here, by the way, I just realized, and I don't think he'd been added to the team yet. I can't remember what issue he joined, but I'm pretty sure it was after they reached international status.
He joined in number 7. So
in number eight, number 6 is on the shelf right now.
Yeah, well, they're
Up next is Martian Manhunter. Woo! Art by Adam Hughes and somebody Nelson.
Diane Nelson, president of DC Comics.
That's right. Or Mark. Maybe it's Mark. and it's basically kind of funny. To me, this is supposed to be a humorous entry because it's JLI, but it's also very dramatic. He's saving a little girl. But he's saving her from a giant safe. You know, like in the cartoons, they're always, you know, for some reason, they're always raising a safe into a bank on a rope. Like, and someone's always underneath it and the safe falls. And here he has obviously caught the safe and saved the little girl and her kitten from the last second. And it's a nice little entry. His face looks a little off. Like maybe it almost looks like he's fallen asleep. But other than that, I think it's a really, really nice entry with a nice use of shade and shadowing. And on the back, you get him as John Jones, the detective, doing, you know, in eating a donut in the police station. You get a nice photograph. He's looking at an old photo of the JLI because you see Booster Gold and Fire and Guy Gardner there. And Guy Gardner's doing little bunny ears behind Martian Manhunter's head in the picture. And then you see him in his alien form sort of worshiping a star, a distant star. So I'll get into the history in a second. But what do you think of the art?
Oh, I think it's terrific. It's Adam Hughes. You know, what's there to complain about Adam Hughes drawing any JLA listing? But you know what I really like about it? Why I think it's so unique?
What's that?
It's a superhero doing something heroic.
There's
really very few of these. I don't mean that as a knock, but it's most of these are pinups of the character looking cool. Very rarely do you see a superhero being a superhero. And here he's saving a little girl and her cat from being crushed by a giant Acme safe. I think it's great. And I see what you're saying about his face, but I took it as that he's straining slightly to lift his safe. And so that you're just catching him in that moment of that kind of thing. I mean, obviously in 2 seconds later, he's going to be able to lift it with one hand because he's very strong. But just we're catching him at that. And the lighting is great. I love the modeling Hughes does with those straight lines on the ink. That's just an interesting little style. And, you know, I mean, Adam Hughes now is very famous, justly so, for his good girl art. And I think that's when people hire him to do pinups. Like, that's all they ever want. You know, it's like, draw Power Girl with her giant tits. You know what I mean? And stuff like that.
Oh, my God.
Well, I mean, really. I mean, come on. That's what it is. But it's nice to see him drawing, like, a man. You know, I mean, he could do lots of cool stuff. So I think it's great. And I love the coloring. I love, like, how almost neon-y green Martian Manhunter is. I think it's just cool. Yeah.
Good choices by Tom McGraw. Nice. Yeah,
very nice.
Now, history here real quick is it's definitely a retcon. This is probably from the JMD Mateus miniseries, I would imagine, where his family was killed by a plague. They changed the story where his family was killed by a plague and the fires of purification. And he's teleported to Earth and he was completely traumatized. He was out of his brain. And Professor Ertl ended up creating a bunch of false memories based on like old sci-fi shows and stuff that he enjoyed, which then and that overlaid onto John Jones's memory. So he didn't so everything we knew about John Jones, they're not saying it was wrong. He had those memories of Mars. They're just saying those were fake implanted memories, and because his family was really all dead. And this, you know, having these sci-fi memories led him to being sort of a superhero and leading that lifestyle, eventually joining the Justice League of America and Justice League International. And he watched a lot of apparently TV police dramas, which inspired him to become John Jones the detective. And at this point, he had figured out that fire was really a psychological weakness because, he watched his family burn. And so now he's no longer weak to fire at this point. Now, of course, they're going to flip that around sooner or later. Someone does his origin again. But at this point, he was no longer weak to fire. Except maybe the beauty of the character fire, I suppose. Anyway, on the shelf at this point was Justice League of America number 45, which is when Guy and Ice try and get their romance going again. So that's good stuff. And his first appearance was back in Detective Comics number 225, all the way back in 1955. Wow. Silver Age character here busting through, folks. One of the earliest Silver Age heroes.
Is that Silver Age?
Well, that's a good discussion. It's a good argument, but it's about the same time that Barry Allen appeared, right?
Just before, and everyone says Showcase number 4 is the beginning of the Silver Age, so he's kind of like pre-Silver Age. He's not Golden Age, but he's pre-Silver.
Well, he'd be like the end of the Golden Age, unless there's an age in between.
There's some weird little overlap there.
Okay, that's interesting. Good point, fair. All right, up next, Booster Gold, the star of the issue. So you've got Booster in the foreground, sort of an action-y pose, but not terribly exciting. And by the way, Dan Jurgens and Mike DiCarlo. And in the surprint, you've got him blasting a guy in armor. You've got a close-up of his face without his costume on. You see him doing a product endorsement. You see him flying. And I failed to mention, in the foreground, in color, is Skeets. So if you don't know Booster Gold, of course you do. He's from the future. He was a football player, college football player with an excellent career. However, he threw it all away because he started betting on his own games, much like Jameis Winston. At that point, he gets busted. He's out of there. He's no longer a football player. He's working in a museum, the Space Museum. And he steals a bunch of artifacts, travels back in time to the 20th century to become a superhero. And he succeeds. And he becomes very popular. He does all these product endorsements, all these things. And most other superheroes don't like him because he's in it for the money and he's in it for the fame. What'd you think?
I wish they had not gotten Mike DiCarlo. Mike DiCarlo kind of like stiffens everybody's artwork up. And I really like Jurgen. So like, I wish I had seen somebody, either Dan ink it himself or somebody else ink it. So just, there's just sort of a, again, I use the same word. There's kind of just like a stiffness to it that I don't necessarily associate with Dan Jurgens' stuff. So I think this is pretty good, but it's like a little bit of a miss for me.
And that could be because I mentioned, you know, he's like almost in an action pose, but doesn't look all that exciting. Maybe it's the inking that did it. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
A couple things to mention. I love his logo because the S is dollars, which is great. As I read his origin here, I didn't realize he met Rip Hunter so early in his adventures. I knew he stole Rip Hunter's time bubble, and I knew Rip Hunter would become very influential in the 2000s Booster Gold series. But I didn't realize I'd forgotten, I guess, that he had met Rip Hunter in the early issues of Booster Gold. Also, one other thing to mention, this is when he had sort of the really short, not quite buzz cut, but fairly short hair versus what I call his floppy hair, which you see on the cover. I like the floppy hair better, personally. I like him with the longer hair, shaggy-ish, if you will. And Booster Gold, by the way, at this point was on issue 19, so he's sailing towards the end of his series. And I forgot to mention, Blue Beetle was on issue 15 at this point, so he still had another 9 issues to go before he got canceled. And both of them, by the way, mentions group affiliation of the Justice League. And Justice League was on only issue 4 at this point, which I think is probably when Booster actually joins the team.
It is.
Yeah, it was 4 or 5. So
4.
I mean, that had just happened. So good timing on that. All right, up next is one of my favorites, Blue Beetle's Bug. Woo! All right, and this one is labeled yellow for technology, folks. Art on the cover is by Grant Meum and Orange Star, and it depicts the bug floating above New York City. It's got a bumper sticker, in fact, on it says, I love New York, and swinging underneath it is Blue Beetle. And if you don't know the bug, it looks like a giant big beetle. It's massive. It's an airship, and a Blue Beetle rides to fly it flies around it. The real highlight of this entry is the text, all right? So this is another way that they're trying to show us that we're going to have some fun here. It's not always going to be stiff.
That opening line, yeah.
What could be more touching than a man and his bug? And it goes on, like at one point here, I'll read this bit because it just cracks me up. The bug's chief weapon is its magno beam that releases magnetic impulse to disrupt foes and electrical charge from the hulls. Its two chief weapons are the magno beams and electric charges, blah, blah, blah. It goes on. Its three chief weapons. Its four chief weapons. Can we just start again? Which is hilarious. Kevin Dooley wrote this, by the way. He was one of the editors on the Justice League books at the time. It is a real riot. It still tells you everything you need, but in a really funny way. They talk about the chair. Blue Beetle's chair was on a track so he could slide around inside the bug. I always thought that looked really cool in the comics. He talks about things. He's got a VCR that's all messed up because he's been playing these cheerleader skin flicks too many times. And he has controls in his gloves, but he stopped using that because every time he punched somebody, it would activate something on the ship. Just really funny stuff. You get to see Booster in the back. So in this one, you don't get a headshot. You just get one big, large image on the bottom of the bug with Beetle and Booster, of course, best friends on there. And I absolutely love this one. It's a real hoot. And at this point in history, for Blue Beetle, they were still in the Giffen DeMatteis run of the Justice League. In fact, they're on JLA number 41. They had just finished that giant, massive Despero story. So, good stuff.
Next up, I'm sure you're going to love this one. Blue Beetle by Ty Templeton. I mean, it's just great. I mean, it's not exact, but it's a slight, I would say, reverse image of the bug listing, because the bug listing had the bug from the top looking down on it, and we saw Beetle descending from it. Well, here now we're below the bug looking up at Beetle as he's falling into the frame. Again, it's not exactly – I don't think it's meant to be an exact parallel, but it's close. It's Ty Templeton. You know, you can't beat it. It's just it's happy. He's got this big smile on his face. The listing gets into a lot of jokes here and there. It mentions – that his height is weight, and height and weight is 5'11", 190, parentheses, needs to diet. Which, I don't know, 5'11", 190 is not in bad shape. I guess for a superhero, that's not great. But, I mean, of course, you know, is befitting the character. It's a very, very kind of, not silly listing, I don't mean to say that, but it's lighthearted, obviously. Written by Kevin Dooley. I like that it mentions, and I've gone over this before, but it's worth saying again since we do this, that when it mentions first appearance, and this is historical, Captain Atom number 83. I love that it mentions other publishers when appropriate. I think that's cool. I like that idea that, you know, it's just because he's owned by DC now doesn't mean he didn't ever exist somewhere else. And on the insets, we see him wahahaing, Shag. That's
Yay!
Right up your alley. We see
literally, there's in the air, it says wahaha.
Yeah, literally. And we see him with the bug. And then, of course, more importantly, him and Booster are about to smack some custard cream pies onto Guy Gardner, which is probably like their most important work, really.
All right. I am very thrilled about this entry. You're right. The front is the pure joy on Ted's face on this completely conveys everything right there. It's so much fun. Now, I'm going to contradict you, surprisingly, right? I don't think this is a reverse of the bug image. Instead, I think this is an homage to the cover of Blue Beetle number 1, the Len Wein, Paris Collins issue. Because that one is – I'm looking at it right now on my phone. It's almost identical. It's actually – you're under the bug. Blue Beetle's dropping on a rope. There you can see the city around it. The sky is even the same orangey-red color. I mean it's like some – I mean he's in a different physical pose, but I mean it's the same exact concept. So I feel like it's that's more of an homage is what it is to Blue Beetle number 1. but it's a great image. Absolutely love it. One thing about the bug, too, if you look at the arms of the bug, they're like really, really mechanical. And I like that. Usually people draw the arms really slick, like a like an actual, you know, insect or something. I like the mechanical look. I think it looks cool. I think it's a nice touch that Ty Templeton added. So
yeah, they're very nice. Very nice. And I love the portrait, the inset portrait.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very distinctive face. I've said this before. Yeah. A lot of other comic book artists can't draw more than one face. It tends to just be this, you know, Superman is Batman. You know, Batman is Superman with a mask. Superman is Aquaman with blonde, you know, blonde hair, that kind of thing. But that's a very distinctive face. I really love the way Templeton drew that. I think it's just terrific.
Well, one of the things we said, Luke Dobb and I, in a recent episode of JLI, the first one Ty Templeton did, is that Ty Templeton really was a great successor for Kevin Maguire on JLI. Because one of the things that, you know, of course, Kevin Maguire is most famous for is his facial expressions, right? The way he does faces, the way they express, they emote, they act, things like that. And Templeton, like, as we really studied it, he does a really darn good job with faces. So he really was the logical heir for Kevin Maguire. And it, you're right, it shows here in the portrait. It's great. I love the occupation, Devil May Care Adventurer. And now I'm jumping a bit of ahead, but you mentioned the half serious, half jokey mix in the description by Kevin Dooley.
Right.
There's actually a letter about, once we get to the letters, there's a letter about the bug entry, and they didn't like it. Whoever, whatever really wound up nerd wrote in did not like the jokiness. And Michael Ure actually says, we hope you like the mix of what we did with Blue Beetle. And I do. I think it works great because you don't miss anything. You get his whole history. It's here. But they just crack a lot of jokes inside of it. And I mean, it's funny, guys. They talk about, well, you know, maybe I'll post – I don't usually post the backside, but maybe I'll post the backside of this one because it's fun.
It says Beetle fancies himself a ladies' man. Unfortunately, the ladies fancy him a nuisance.
That's exactly right. They do talk about him and Booster falling out because at this point, Booster had just quit the Justice League, actually. And one of the things that – I forget this a lot. You know, Booster and Beetle are famous for – they're trying to get the get-rich-quick schemes, right? This says it here, and someone else told me on a recent JLI podcast that I guess I never picked up on, that they said Beetle is the one who's usually concocting these schemes. And in my mind, it was Booster, but this says it was Beetle. The other person I was talking with said it was Beetle. So I guess Ted's the worst influence, really. He's the problem. He's the problem child there. So anyway, red entry for Hero, no doubt about that, obviously. And Justice League right now is on issue number 44, Justice League America. And that's the one where they had a couple issues where they were at, like, the supervillain bar with the poker and stuff like that. It's really fun stuff. Up next is – this is what you've all been waiting for, folks. And I'll read right at what it says in the entry. It says Guy Gardner, the one, comma, true Green Lantern. Woo! All right, folks. Yes, Guy has got his own entry. I love this. He is in an action pose. He is using his ring to make a fist because his own fist is not good enough. And he is punching the crap out of some Russian soldiers, which is awesome, which is exactly what I want Guy Gardner to be doing because that's where his happy place. We always say find your joy. His joy is going over to Russia and starting fights. So that's perfect. It is drawn by Joe Staton. Now, I have said a lot of not nice things about Joe Staton on this show over the years about his work in the 1980s being too cartoony. And I will tell you here, this is still too cartoony. However, for some reason, of all the characters, Guy Gardner is, I guess because he put such a stamp on that character that, like, I can accept his cartooniness. I'm Guy Gardner, I suppose. What do you think of this?
I like it. I mean, like I said, I'm much more favorable to Joe Staton's cartooniness than you. But no, I like this a lot. Like I said, I like the goofy listing, the one true Green Lantern. He maybe gets a little far on the inset where Guy Gardner's head is completely flat. I mean, like, you could, like, land a plane on his head, maybe a little much.
Right.
But I like the insets a lot. So overall, I like it quite a bit. And I like the action lines. I like that the camera's kind of pointing toward – all the action lines are pointing to the center, which is Guy slapping the crap out of – or about to punch the one Russian with his ring. So I think it's very good.
I love the front entry. There's a piece on the back that is sort of bothersome to me nowadays, though. He and Ice are clearly having words because, you know, there's a romantic relationship between him and Ice, but it's never easy. And clearly they're disagreeing on something because she's sort of got her back turned to him with her hands behind her in a pose. And he's sort of holding the door closed as if to say, no, no, let me finish. I want to talk to you. You know, almost like he's not letting her out of the room. But I know she's perfectly capable of moving him out of her way. I mean, she's ice. She's extremely powerful. But I don't know. That panel sort of bothers me a little bit. I don't know. Am I reading more into it than I should?
I think so. I didn't take it that he was holding the door shut. I took it that he's just leaning up against something and she's not facing him.
Oh, okay. So like he's hitting on her maybe? That could be.
Trying to talk to her and she's kind of giving him literally the cold shoulder.
Yeah. I like that. That's good. All right. So a few things about Guy. As you read this entry, you know, he's got a very, very sad history because, you know, he is a good person. He really is. He was the backup Green Lantern, but then all this crap went wrong. He got injured. He got brain damage. Hal Jordan slept with his girlfriend while he had to watch. He got trapped in another dimension. Really screwed up crap happened to this guy. And every time he gets bumped on the head, his personality changes. I mean, he has serious mental issues and no other superhero cares. He gets bumped on the head, he changes personality, and everyone just laughs. At no point does anyone say, maybe you should go to a doctor, Guy. It's crazy how much they don't care. So, and here's the thing, like, Guy Gardner, I kind of segment him in my brain. Like, in the JLI, he's funny. You know, he's over the top, he's funny, he's very, you know, pro-fighting and Republican and all this stuff, and it's very humorous. Outside of the JLI, I'm not always the biggest fan of him. Until his ongoing series that was written by Beau Smith. That's a whole different thing. But anyway, it's fantastic. I love it. Anyway, but I never was a huge fan of Guy Gardner outside of the JLI. But then this entry made me think about it. It talks about here how he's actually really, really brave. And he's really, really heroic. And he's really, really loyal. And that's all true. It really, those really are good descriptors for him. However, that comes bagged or packaged with a bunch of baggage. He's stubborn, he's sexist, he's rude, he's arrogant, and he's impatient, which is really unpleasant. But he is still brave and loyal and heroic. He is doing the right thing, at least what he thinks is the right thing. And so I started thinking about this, Rob. At this point in time, in 1992, was there any other character like him that was still doing the right thing but was basically a complete asshole about it? I can't – you know, I'm not putting the Punisher in the same category because that's a whole different kind of thing. But can you think of anyone else?
That's a good question. Yeah, no, he really did kind of stand out. He was kind of like the natural evolution of the kind of Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone hyper-testosteroned male figure. And he was kind of that wrapped up but as a superhero. So, yeah, he certainly stood out at the time. I remember that. I mean, I was buying those comics. So, yeah, he was unique.
And I think a lot of us hated him for it, but I kind of love him for that, though, because there are people out there like that that can be doing the right thing and you still don't have to like them. You know, I know a lot of people that I'm not a big fan of, but they're doing the right thing. So, I don't know. I kind of like Guy Gardner for that. He's different. I wouldn't want to hang out with him in real life, that's for sure. Anyway,
no.
So a couple other things. Now, Joe Staton did the artwork here because he had drawn this old Green Lantern core issues. And also, he was doing the Green Lantern book was doing something very interesting. They would do story arcs where it'd be like a Hal Jordan story arc, which would be drawn by Pat Broderick. They would do a Guy Gardner arc, which would be drawn by Joe Staton. And then they would do a John Stewart arc, which was drawn by Mark Bright. And they would, the ideal was going to be that they would just keep cycling these, you know, and everyone would get a turn for a few issues. And Guy Gardner had just finished up a run at issues 9 through 12 with spotlighting him. So that was sort of a different time. And now in about 10 months, he will get his own ongoing series though. And so he'll be a breakout character, if you will. But so, lots of interesting stuff on him. So at this point, as I said, you check out that Green Lantern comic. Oh, and I should have mentioned Jose Marzan did the inking. I didn't bother to mention that, so I should have. Oh, Kevin Dooley wrote it, and it's also Red Border. Sorry, I'm just dropping the ball here.
And it ends on his whole bit about the General Glory haircut.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, there you go. Awesome. All right, let's get into our first entry. It is Big Barda by Adam Hughes and Carl Story, and it is amazing. So in the foreground, on the right-hand side, you've got a shot, not a full body shot, but from head to maybe about her knees, a Big Barda. She's in her costume. It's, you know, it's amazingly illustrated by Adam Hughes. She looks beautiful. She looks tough. She's got the mega rod, and it's glowing with this really great bright glowing effect. And then behind her, actually almost a serpent, Rob, almost a serpent, you see a Barda's face without the costume, and then you see her in her little tiny bikini holding up her husband, Mr. Miracle, who's bound up in chains, and they're clearly at the circus there. And also in the background, you see the planet Apocalypse with its fire pits. What do you think of the cover? Or I always call it the cover. I'm sorry. What do you think of the art?
Oh, it's – I mean, Adam Hughes drawing any woman is already a winner, and then especially drawing Big Barda because it's – he gets to show off – he gets to put her in very, very skimpy clothing, but of course she's showing off her muscles.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I mean, it's cheesecake certainly, but it's a different kind of cheesecake. And as I'll say, as much as I love the front image, my favorite one is actually the back of her lifting up the van to rescue the little kitten.
Aww.
And the way she leans over everybody, because she's huge.
Yeah.
I mentioned here she's 6'2", and so I love how she's leaning into the frame there. And then, of course, her hugging Scott is great. It's a great listing. And this is one of these characters that was always, you know, in the periphery of the DC universe. I mean, she's created by Jack Kirby. She's a New Gods character, but really has become kind of a much bigger deal thanks to, I think, new women fans coming into the comic books and discovering this character, this powerful character, and now she's kind of a much bigger deal.
Well, and I want to give some credit to Justice League International for putting her in that book and making her a character of note, and then spinning off the Mr. Miracle series originally by J.M.D. Mateus and making her a regular, because she had been sidelined since the 70s, really, and so they started the ball rolling, and then other people have done so much with her that, yeah, she's absolutely a big deal. She was even in, what do you call that, DC Superhero Girls show, which, you know, was directly targeted at young girls, and she was a big deal in that, so that's great. Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned Jack Kirby created by, because Jack does get credit for creating her here in this, which is wonderful. And the border's red for Hero. First appearance is all the way back in Mr. Miracle, number 4, which was 1971. And so the deal with her, if you don't know her origin, folks, I'll just go through her super quick. She's from Apocalypse. She was taken care of by Granny Goodness in the orphanages. She was leader of the Female Furies. Then she ended up rebelling from that group, came to Earth and hooked up with Scott Free, who's Mr. Miracle, eventually marries him. And this piece really talks more about their recent adventures, because, you know, they had the Mr. Miracle ongoing series where they were living in Bailey, New Hampshire. And so this focuses a lot on that. Now, and I know you already know this part, I always find this fascinating, though, is when Jack Kirby created Big Barda, sort of one of the inspirations he used was Lainey – I don't know if I'm saying your name right. Kazan? Is that right?
Yeah, Lainey Kazan.
Yep. And she had appeared in Playboy shortly before this. And that was sort of an inspiration for the physique of Big Barda. You know, this very large – forgive the expression. Big boned would be a way to put it. But just a large frame woman who's still beautiful and sexy, though. And so that's what he based her on. And I didn't know the name. And I looked her up. Sure enough, she's extremely well known nowadays for being in, you know, My Big Fat Greek Wedding. So she's still out there doing stuff. And Mark Evanier, who was Jack Kirby's assistant, once said that Scott and Barda were sort of jokingly based on Jack Kirby and his wife's relationship. So I think that's kind of funny. Mm. Yeah, I know. Makes you wonder what Jack thought about that. So some things that I love about Barda that they introduced in the Justice League International era, and they really played up in the ongoing series, was her in the housewife kind of role, where there's a lot of comedy gold to be found in this battle-hardened warrior trying to fit in suburban America, and how she was just so bound and determined to make it work, because she never loses a fight. And so in her opinion, she was going to make this work, and it was just hysterical. And they pick on it here in The Powers. They even mention how she her deadliest weapon is probably her cooking, which has been known to make even the strongest man cringe. So Kevin Dooley wrote the text, who was the assistant editor on a lot of the funny Justice League books at the time. So one other thing worth noting here is under group affiliations, Justice League International is not listed, which I find surprising because she appeared in so many issues. But technically, I guess she was never a member. Does that track with you?
I don't remember her ever being a member. But of course, during that book, the membership was very loose. Like there was no, you know, it wasn't like the old series where they made a big deal about when you joined the team. And the new book, it was like people just came and go left and right. So I don't know.
Well, it bothers me. I mentioned in a recent JLI podcast, and I'm curious from feedback from you guys at home, if you thought, because I just assumed she was a member of the JLI. I've got her action figure in my JLI collection. That's where it belongs. But anyway.
It's weird that it lists the New Gods as a group affiliation, because like I didn't really think that was a team. That was the name of the book.
Good point.
But, like, I didn't know that was like an actual team name. The Female Fury Battalion, yeah, but the New Gods, I didn't really think that was a thing.
Yeah, they could have said something about New Genesis, maybe. You know, like being part of a upper society of New Genesis. But yeah, that's a good point. Huh. Well, at this point, the Mr. Miracle series had just been canceled the month before this. Very sad. And she had appeared most recently, though, in the Justice League International Annual, which was tied in Armageddon 2001. Up next is Mr. Miracle, Hot Dog. And this is – who drew this, Rob?
penciled and inked by Jim Aparo, which for 1991, that's pretty rare. He wasn't inking a lot of his own work at this point, so I have no idea why he's drawing this, because he doesn't have any real great connection to this character. Maybe he just requested it, but it's cool. It's super cool. I mean, you know, I'm never going to be not happy about Jim Aparo inking himself.
Dude, this is an amazing piece. I mean, he's got to be doing it because of his love of Jack. That's the only – I mean, he's got to be, right? Sorry, what?
I said, I guess. He drew him a lot in Brave and the Bold, but other than that, I don't know what any connection Aparo had to this character.
Well, I mean, Jack Kirby. I'm saying he's got to be for his love of Jack Kirby, yeah.
Right.
So it's his great shot, and Mr. Miracle is bound up in some crazy gadget. You know, he was always bound up in this weird tech, trying, you know, in like some escape, death-defying escape. And he's bound up in this thing, and it looks like it's being swung on a pendulum, and is being blasted with lasers, and he's trying to break free. And it's just he's upside down. The artwork is great. The line work is great. The expression on his face. I mean, it is a great representation of Mr. Miracle by Jim Aparo, and it's a great drawing. It's super fun. You got buzzsaws on the bottom. I love it.
Yeah, I love that he's upside down. Yes. I think that's terrific.
And it feels very Kirby. It feels genuinely Kirby, which is nice too. So the gist of Mr. Miracle, just to go through this fairly quick, and this, to be specific, this is Mr. Miracle scot-free, and that's important. You know, his father is High Father from New Genesis. They, him and Darkseid, in order to make a peace treaty, they swapped sons. So scot-free went to go live on Apocalypse, and in exchange, Darkseid gave his son, Orion, to go to New Genesis. While on Apocalypse, scot-free was raised by Granny Goodness in the orphanage. I like what it says here. It says he escaped Apocalypse, and the entire planet is a prison, so it was a miracle that he escaped. I'm like, oh, that's clear. I like the way they played that. So he comes to Earth, he meets the original Mr. Miracle, Thaddeus Brown, who ends up being killed. He then takes his place as the new Mr. Miracle, and he tours all over the country doing escape artist tricks. He hooks up with Barda, literally. Oberon works with him as assistants. They battle Darkseid. He ends up getting married. He joins the Justice League International. He lives in Bailey, New Hampshire. All this stuff. Ends up back in New York. So lots and lots of stuff on there. The gist of it is he is the greatest escape artist of all time. And he uses his mother box, which you may remember from the Justice League movie, to let him do all kinds of things. And he has these flying discs on his feet. And I love this character. He is always fun. He never gives up. He's a loving husband. He's a great adventurer. He's got this great sense of legacy because of Thaddeus. He's the showmanship. I just adore this guy. Would you have a strong connection with this character at all?
Yeah, I always like Mr. Miracle. He was definitely more of a superhero, obviously, than the other New Gods, which is, I think, why when DC canceled all the New Gods books, they kept the Mr. Miracle book going. And actually, Marshall Rogers took over and drew it for a while, and that's really cool. Again, his costume is great. He had a superpowers figure, which I had. He was super beefy. He doesn't really look like the Mr. Miracle I'm familiar with, but he's still really cool. No, he's a great character. It's kind of fun when they team him up with Batman. You would think that there would be a lot of overlap there, but there's something fun about having one guy who's just really good at this one thing. Then he even can outdo Batman. Like, I think that's really cool. That, like, yeah. So of course Batman is a master escape artist, but Mr. Miracle's just a little better, which I dig a lot.
I've always liked this character, and I think in my reread of Justice League International has made me love him even more. I really love his appearances in there because it's fun. It's not only is he a great action hero, he's funny. You know, there's a great comedic element to it too, and his own ongoing series was lots of fun. In preparation for this episode, I got a little excited, so I dug out on the DC Unlimited app or DC Universe app, and I started rereading the Mr. Miracle series. And it's interesting, you know, when it started, the first few issues, his personality really wasn't there. Like, he's definitely a hero, and he's doing the right thing. But it's sort of like a Silver Age comic in that he's got a set of powers that define, or abilities that define him, not his personality. His personality is just hero, straightforward, let's go. And it's almost like not even reading Scott, which is interesting. Today I rewatched an episode of Justice League Unlimited, The Ties That Bind, which is all about Mr. Miracle and Big Barda and Flash going to Apocalypse, and that was super fun watching that. I really enjoyed that. Lots and lots of fun. So at this point, he's active with the JLI. I told you all the stuff with Barda, all that applies there too. Moving on.
Hold on one second. Now I got to get down the explicit tag for the show. All right.
This is where we'll start,
done,
folks. Yep. That's right. Yep. Okay. Because we are doing an Adam Hughes drawing of fire. Yes.
Go ahead, Jack. Get it out of your system.
Thank you. Smoking hot. I'm sorry. There is nobody listening to this podcast that will disagree with me that this drawing is not done to elicit a sexual response. That's fact. It is, of course, Beatrice DaCosta.
You don't hire Adam Hughes unless you're trying to get a sexual response for
his
drawings.
Right. It is Beatriz DaCosta. On the front, she's wearing her current costume from Justice League America, where she's got basically, it's like a little, very tiny bustier. Her large breasts are pouring out of it. She's
made
got
from
a little
adamantium, face. Apparently.
Yeah, right. She's got this little, actually, she looks a lot like Rogue in this drawing, actually, now look at it. She's got a little tiny jacket on, and everything's in green tones, and she's got a little headband and gloves and high, you know, jeans. She's showing her belly, and this belt is very, very sexy. In the background, again, Adam Hughes did a great job. This is another entry that really figured out how to use the page. You know, they have a brick wall behind her with all these posters of her throughout different points in her life. Her as a showgirl, her as, you know, the character from Justice League, her and her friend Ice. And then I guess that's probably Adam Hughes in the background peeking out over her armpits. I don't know what that is, but you see what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah, the photo. Yeah. That probably is him, yeah.
Imagine. So the logo's a little kind of lame, but they tried to do something different. They tried to be like little letters with flames behind it. But either way, created by E. Nelson Bridwell and Ramona Fraiden. Look at that, buddy. Look at that.
I love that if you knew nothing about the history of this character, and you just – but you knew what the Super Friends book was, you see this drawing and you're like, wait, that was in Super Friends? Like, what's going on?
Or the other way around, if you look at this and think of Fire, who you know from Justice League, and you look at this and go, she came from the Super Friends?
Yeah.
And she was a nightclub dancer and a spy? What? So, yes, that's her history here. She's Brazilian-born. She was a nightclub showgirl. Then she, of course, went and became a government spy because those two careers matched perfectly. She ended up on a mission where there was this machine that created pyroplasm, and she ended up getting caught in this explosion of pyroplasm, which gave her powers, which at that point was she could breathe. That's right, short bursts of green flaming breath. Yes, about 12 inches long. That's about all she could do. Now, it could get pretty hot, like an acetylene torch, but she could blow fire. That was it. She joined the Global Guardians as Green Fury and then Green Flame, and then eventually she became friends with Ice Maiden, who was part of the Global Guardians. And after the Global Guardians shut down, they came to New York and declared their intentions to join the Justice League International. Martian Manhunter was not impressed, however, when they were shorthanded, they needed some help, and they became probationary members and proved themselves to be incredibly valuable members of the team. When the Invasion Gene Bomb went off, it changed her powers, and she essentially became a green human torch. So think of it that way. That's her powers. And some of the interesting things about her is she's incredibly clever and street smart. She's very impulsive, and she doesn't seem to take things very seriously. But really, she's a lot more dependable than most people think. And she uses her sexiness and her flirting, which she's very overt, very sexual creature. She uses this on purpose to distract people and make them sort of underestimate her abilities because she's actually quite competent. And she usually takes people by surprise in that way. She's an above average – it says here she's an above average hand-to-hand combatant. It should be a lot higher. She can really kick the ass. Like when she was in a government spy role and then later on some of the Justice League issues before she had her powers, she could kick the crap out of anybody. So she really – I'd say it's a lot more than above average. But anyway, right now at this point in Justice League history, they're on Justice League of America number 41, which is right after that Despero storyline I mentioned earlier.
Great,
and,
great story.
Oh, yeah. Now, I should have mentioned the writing was done by Mark Waid.
It would not be a Who's Who episode if I don't make a quibble about the height or weight. And here it says Hot Fire is 5'8", which is very tall for a woman, 130 pounds. Nope. She's not 100. No woman who is 5'8 is 130 unless she is stick thin. And no woman built like a brick you-know-what house that Fire is 130 pounds.
Fair enough. Okay. All right, up next is Ice by Adam Hughes. Absolutely adorable. It really walks that line of adorable girl next door and who's cute. And, you know, there's a little bit of sexiness in there just because it's Adam Hughes. He can't keep it out of there. So on the art, Ice is sort of cuddling a baby seal, which looks so adorable. And in the background, there are two people who are clearly going to kill and bash the baby seal. And they are frozen solid within a block of ice. Again, Adam Hughes can't go wrong there when he's drawing the ladies. What do you think of this one?
Oh, it's beautiful. It's fantastic. I can only hope that the guys that Ice is encasing in ice slowly die of starvation. So it's fantastic. I love it. I love how happy the seal looks. It tells you everything about Ice that you need to know. Beautiful piece. And again, as you mentioned, it's Adam Hughes can draw. Obviously, Adam Hughes is the guy you get when you want to draw really sexy women. But Ice is beautiful and alluring and sweet. But it's not that's not dripping with sexuality either.
Right.
So I think it's great. And again, I love the insets. I love Fire tickling her.
and she's laughing, and then we see her using her powers. It's great. And then making ice cubes for the other members of the Justice League. Great piece. Great piece.
Well, absolutely wonderful. It does have created by credit here, E. Nelson Bridwell, or Birdwell. Is it Bridwell? Or, oh, I don't have my glasses here. Oh, Bridwell, okay. Bridwell, and Ramona Fraiden. I thought it was misspelled. So. And Ramona Fraiden, of course, from the Super Friends, number 9 in December 1977, which was her first appearance. A lot of people forget that. First appeared in Super Friends and yet made it into regular continuity. Now, a lot of this is just a retelling of her Secret Origins issue. She had that covered on Ryan's Secret Origins podcast, which was fantastic. The gist of it is the country of Norway was really anxious to join the Global Guardians, and they needed a hero. So they sought out their mythical, legendary, magical ice people that lived in their country they knew of. So eventually they found them. They sent this engineer to go find them. Well, they were this, you know, quiet little isolated community, and this engineer gets there and he meets them. And of course, Tora, who is, you know, ice, she was smitten with the engineer, and he talks her into coming off to see his world. And she left with the engineer. She joins the Global Guardians. She's there. She's called Ice Maiden. She becomes friends with Green Flame, which didn't actually happen in any of those comics. It was retconned in JLI. She joins the JLI. She changes her name to Ice to go along with her friend Fire. They're just besties. And they describe her quite well here. She's naive. She's kind of sweet. She's very soft-spoken. But she's powerful. You know, she can generate ice. We're not talking, she can't freeze the New York Harbor, but she can generate enough ice to stop a moving vehicle, which is, I'm pretty impressed. I can't stop a moving vehicle, so I think that's pretty good. And at this point in Justice League history, Justice League number 43, or Justice League America number 43, was on the shelves. It was just a few months away from Guy and Ice's relationship developing further, because if you remember, one of the funny stories was that she and Guy Gardner fell in love. So you got this sweet naive girl with the horrible, horrible, horrible Guy Gardner. They made a great sort of, you know, what's that expression? Chalk and thanks for your help.
I don't know what you're trying to say. You're coming up with phrases that don't exist. I'm sorry.
No, there is. There's a phrase. Someone's going to put in the comments. It was when two things are opposite but they go well together. You know, it's chalk and cheese. There it is. Wow. It's like chalk and cheese. It's a British thing. Just
that. Oh my god.
Expand your horizons, Rob. Quit being so ethnocentric. Learn about other countries. Like Ice. She's from Norway. Oh my god.
Next is one of your favorites, of course. Mm-hmm. Maxwell Lord first appeared in Justice League number 1. The art is by Ty Templeton. This is a beautiful...
Hell yes, it is.
Beautiful, beautiful. Interesting, no creator credit for Maxwell Lord. That's kind of unusual because he's such a recent creation. A beautiful listing of Max in his office, and he's got all his bric-a-brac around him. We see that he's got a nice window view of the city. He's got his little ping-pong, not a ping-pong paddle, that rubber ball. I forget what those things are called. Paddle ball. Yeah, right. He's got a bunch of stuff, and he's making a business deal. The one little detail that was interesting is that we see a painting on the left-hand side. It's cut off by the image, and presumably that's Maxfield Parish, going by the name, because we hear L-ish.
Oh, okay.
I don't really understand the connection other than the Max, that he just – Max Will Lord is interested in a painter whose name is the first name similar to his. I'm seeing Max Will Lord is more of a Nagel kind of guy, like kind of 80s type stuff.
I was going to say Nagel was really popular in the 80s. Was Maxfield Parrish popular at that point? I don't really know.
I mean, he's kind of an eternal painter. He's from the earlier part of the 19th century. He's born in Philadelphia, by the way. I don't really – again, it might just be Max. Like, that's his ego, is that he wants to have some renowned person who has the same first name as him. I like the logo where it looks like a business plate, like you would see on his desk. I think that's a nice detail. And
on a door, really, is what it looks like.
Right.
Door.
Yeah. On the inset, we see him discovering the secret sanctuary. We see him talking to Martian Manhunter, who looks dubious. And then him using – the after effects of him using his mental powers is where he gets nosebleeds. And we see Guy Gardner in the background looking clueless. And they mention in the powers and weapons.
Oh, wait. You got to mention, the whole reason he has a nosebleed is because he's making Guy Gardner take out the trash.
And
Guy Gardner's taking out the trash, and he's clueless why he's taking out the trash. It's because Max has done that to him.
And he talks about in the powers and weapons that he always has to have a large supply of red handkerchiefs on hand to cover up the blood. So, yeah, I mean, you can't beat Ty Templeton, especially him making himself. It's just a beautiful piece. It's an example of how you can make a really captivating entry listing without necessarily having it be an action thing, because it's just the guy in an office. But it's so beautifully drawn, and it gives you so much insight into the character that it's really a nice piece. Probably one of the best in the book.
It is one of my favorites, absolutely. And the only motion on the entire piece, because he's sitting with his feet up on his desk, guys, the only motion is the paddle ball.
Right.
And it just works great because it tells you he's on the phone, but he's still, you know, it's JLI. They only take it so seriously. You know, the background you can see is, I love the detail, the office detail that he put, like the Apple IIe or whatever that's on the table behind him. And I love that
he's got a pair of binoculars. Matrix printer.
Right, a dot matrix printer, yeah. I love they have the binoculars because that's what people do who have offices really high up in the sky. They keep binoculars because they look at other windows, through other windows and stuff. You know, he clearly hates me peeping on people in other buildings. I love this entry so freaking much. And let's see what else. I find the alter egos hysterical. It says alter egos Amazing Wombat Man and Maximum Force. And then it says both known only to himself. So I got to think that's Kevin Dooley having some fun there. There is a whole thing in here too. Oh, I got to find it. Where is it? Okay. So, because, you know, I've gone over the origin of Maxwell Lord on JLI. He started off being controlled by a computer. That wasn't the secret sanctuary he's finding, by the way. You said down in the inset picture. That's him finding the evil apocalyptian or new god,
oh,
whatever.
That's
new
right. Computer. That's right. That's right.
So it talks about how he betrayed everyone and then he came around and he became a good guy. So it says here, at the risk of his life, he asserted his will against the computer. And on that day, Maxwell Lord, heartless, conniving pond scum, was virtually gone forever, replaced by the seemingly heartless and seemingly conniving and seemingly pond scum we now know today. Which cracks me up because Max stopped being, you know, essentially a bad guy, but he's still pretty sleazy. He's still, you know, an 80s/90s sleazy business guy because corporations were the bad guys at that point in history. So in popular culture, I love it. Absolutely love it. And Justice League, I mentioned earlier, is on JLA number 42 at this point, and Max is going to play a role in a couple upcoming issues. So you should check that out. We're just going to keep rolling here because up next is Oberon, another logo which is sort of boring, except I find it hilarious because Oberon is a little person and his logo is freaking huge and takes up the top half of the page. I just think that's very funny. Art here is by Joe Phillips and Bob Dvorak. Now, Joe Phillips was drawing the Mr. Miracle book, which is why you get Oberon's entry drawn by him. You've got Maxwell Lord sitting there looking a little harangued with his hand like rubbing his neck, and Oberon is standing on a stool so he can look at Max almost eye to eye and is just berating him. He has given Max the business. And behind them, you see Scott Free as Mr. Miracle. You see Barda. You see Shiloh, the new Mr. Miracle. And you see General Glory, actually. He makes an appearance here. And I think it's a fun piece. I don't know. It's interesting they put the checkerboard tile on the ceiling when I'm pretty sure the JLI was always famous for having the checkerboard floor. But I don't know. What do you think of this one? okay. Fair enough.
Yeah. I will say it took me numerous times looking at this before I noticed that there were two Mr. Miracles.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of this one.
Okay, I like it. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. It's not extraordinarily dynamic. The art is fine. The proportions are fine. I love Oberon standing on the stool, so I think it's fine. Again, it's not flashy, exciting like Major Forces entry, but I don't think there's anything wrong with it. All right. So I do like the inset pictures. He sort of replicated the cover to JLI number 23, where Oberon goes all Rambo. I love that. And you've got him crying over the dead body of Thaddeus Brown, who was the previous Mr. Miracle, and then you've got him as the JLI monitor duty. So the gist is, you know, Oberon, as I said, he's a little person. He ended up in a circus and ended up eventually as an assistant to Thaddeus Brown, the original Mr. Miracle. There he meets Scott Free. Thaddeus dies. Scott Free becomes the new Mr. Miracle and Oberon becomes his assistant. Of course, they meet Big Bard and stuff like that. But the best thing about this entry is they talk about his powers. Under powers, they talk about how he is quick thinking. He is a down and dirty street fighter. They call him Billy Goat Gruff as his personality. Or Billy Goat Gruff personified. I like that. And how he is irresistible to women. And they really hit home, too, how his family is now Scott and Barda and the JLI. That makes me very happy. And it's written by Kevin Dooley. And first appearance is Mr. Miracle, number one in 1971. And the border is supporting cast blue. I would argue it could be red.
All right. Next is Nort.
Yay! You said it right.
How was she supposed to say it?
Well, there's a lot of people don't know whether you say Gnort or...
Oh, I always assumed it was Nort, yeah.
It is just Nort.
From Justice League International number 10, drawn by my pal Stephen DeStefano and inked by Richard Brunning. I never liked Nort all that much. I felt like it was like a funny joke that just went on way too long. Like I like the idea of kind of like a Green Lantern that got pushed through the system because he was a legacy. Like, that's a funny idea, but like, I think it just went on, it just kept going, and I was like, all right, now it's not really funny anymore. But you know, here it's fine. DiStefano is a perfect artist for a humor character, and they really bring it up. You know, they really play it up here. He's playing. What's that? What is he playing? Cricket. Okay. He's playing cricket or croquet, and he's drinking some coffee, and then he's scratching himself like a dog. So, because he is a dog, and he's lighting his cigarette with his Green Lantern ring. So, you know, it's cute.
I've done, being that I'm doing a Justice League International Blahaha podcast coming out in March, I've done a lot of research on this character. Because I wasn't a big fan of the character either back in the day, especially when like Joe Staton would draw him. You know, it didn't do much for me. But now that I've done my research on it and I'm rereading this right now, at least so far up through issue 24, 25, 26, somewhere in there of Justice League, I'm in love with this character. He is hilarious. He is so funny. And reading some interviews and stuff, I found out when Keith Giffen and J.M.D. Mateus created him, their intention was originally he was supposed to be based on Ed Norton from The Honeymooners.
Okay, I can see that.
They even gave him the vest, you know, to sort of match up with that. And Nort is a Norton. As time went by, Mark DeMatteis kept rolling in aspects of Woody Allen. So he's supposed to be a cross between Ed Norton and Woody Allen, but more Woody Allen towards the end. So very interesting. So it's kind of funny, as you said, that he got pushed through and became a Green Lantern. So they gave him a sector completely devoid of life. And he calls his power ring, he calls it a ringy dingy, which was always cute. And then I was wondering why DiStefano drew this, because he didn't draw any Justice Leagues as far as I knew, but he drew Nort's origin in Secret Origins number 34.
Ah, okay. I assumed it was just because Nort's a humor character and DiStefano was good at this.
Oh, it's a good fit, certainly, yeah. And I love the fact that he's smoking. That's just not something you saw superheroes do. Up next is another interesting one, General Glory, by Linda Medley, and she's given layout assist credit, and this is awesome, to J.C. Leyendecker. Now, do you know who that is, Ron?
Yes, he was a very, very famous illustrator from the turn of the century. He did a poster called Weapons for Liberty, which was a U.S. Bonds poster, which is what this design is based off of.
Awesome. Very good. And he went on to do a ton of Saturday Evening Post covers. And apparently, he is second only to Norman Rockwell in the number of Saturday Evening Post covers he did.
I looked at his Wikipedia page, and it mentioned that he died on his estate. So that tells you how long ago it was that a freelance illustrator had an estate.
That's pretty true. That is pretty true. So, yes, it's a very Golden Age feel. You've got General Glory, who is he's a Captain America riff, okay? And we're going to have to talk about that in a minute. I mean, he's got sort of red-white striped pants. He's got blue boots with stars, very patriotic. He's got, like, an eagle across his chest that goes to his shoulders. He's got a blue cowl with a star. He looks super, super-duper patriotic. In this shot, he's holding a giant American flag, and behind him is a kind of sexy Statue of Liberty. I don't know if you noticed that or not, but – and he's got the logo.
Okay, Shaq.
Well, I'm just saying, she's hot. Anyway, he's got General Glory, and he's got the flag in the logo. It's very patriarchal. It says Heroes for Liberty right on there. So what do you think of the entry?
It's nice. His costume – I know that he was meant to be kind of a gag character. His costume looks like what you would have seen in a montage of Captain America trying to design his uniform before he came up with the one we all know. That's what fair. It looks like, because it's really just – it's got the stripes and the eagle, but it's all kind of much more kind of silly looking, at least compared to the Captain America one. But, I mean, it's meant to be a riff on that, and I really like the his version of the Red Skull guy in the background, the guy with the half skull mask with the swastika on the side of his head. Yeah. That's a cool design.
I love the glasses he's wearing over the Red Skull thing. It's hilarious. Now, I know, and this is where we're going to hear from Chris Franklin. He's already writing a message about how this was his breaking point for the JLI. But I know General Glory is a breaking point for a lot of people. A lot of people have a hard time. They feel like the JLI got too goofy at this point. But, you know, I haven't reread all of them. I've reread here or there spot stuff. And, of course, I will get to it all with the podcast. But there's more to it there. Yes, he's a gag. Yes, he's a parody of Captain America. But they're using it to tell some interesting stories about patriotism, or about being a hero, or about Guy Gardner and things like that, which is all part of this story. And I think there's more to it there. So I'm looking forward to getting in deeper and rereading those stories. So it says here his first appearance is Justice League America number 46, which is 1991. And
I found out that may not actually be true. If memory serves, I think it was Tim Price who brought it to my attention. But it turns out it's 7 months before this first appearance, there was a mention of a General Glory in a Huntress comic, which is also edited by Andy Helfer. And they had an old General Glory comic book in there. So it almost seems like this might have been, you know, planned in advance, which is kind of cool symmetry. Anyway, General Glory, is back in the 1940s, during World War II, he had this – it was this guy, and he had this mantra he would say, "Lady of Liberty, hear my plea for the land of the brave and the home of the free." And he'd turn into General Glory, who was known as America's heroes, defender of freedom, writer of badness. And the entry is very tongue-in-cheek, written by Kevin Dooley. There's a lot of these ridiculous sort of descriptors for him. But he fought in World War II as an American GI. Again, very much a parody of Captain America. He had a sidekick named Ernie, who was a lot like Bucky. But Ernie had a ridiculous bowl haircut, just like Guy Gardner would have years later. That's on purpose. And the government published a General Glory comic book to sort of fool people into thinking he was a fictional character. So if news got out about General Glory's activities, they just didn't assume he wasn't real. Well, during World War II, he ended up, as they put it, going into the ice. Sound familiar? And when he went into the ice, he was rescued, but he forgot the magic words which turned him into General Glory. So he just became an old man. He grew old. Joseph Jones grew much, much, much older. Well, years later, he ended up seeing the comic book that featured his mantra. He read it, and he was transformed back into the young man of General Glory again. So he had an opportunity to, you know, he goes back and forth from being an old man to being the young General Glory. And again, super patriotic. There's a lot of goofiness, tongue-in-cheek in there. But Guy Gardner, growing up, General Glory was his hero. And that's why, supposedly, retconned, why Guy Gardner has that ridiculous bowl cut, is because he was sort of honoring Ernie, the sidekick. So that's where that comes from.
Wow.
So, I know. It's a little goofy. So General Glory ends up joining the JLI. He becomes a member of the team. So bottom, I guess the bottom – and oh, the powers are funny. General Glory, he of the contagious smile, he of the sparkling eyes, he of the big chin, carries no weapons, for he believes a man's natural talents can overcome all obstacles. He can lift a tank but will ache for weeks. He can run for days in the desert without sunscreen. Although he's not invulnerable, he's pretty darn hard to hurt. So again, sort of like a Superman – sort of. I mean, it's Captain America sort of powers. The whole thing is corny, yes. But is it fun? I also would stand by and say it's fun. Now, did you read any of the General Glory stuff?
I think with Chris, this was right around the point where I gave up on the book. I was just like, this is just getting too silly. And I started fading out.
Okay. That's fair enough. All right. Well, I
like the artwork. I like Linda Medley's artwork, but I just, yeah. I remember just kind of going like, oh, now we're getting parody characters into the team? Okay. I don't know.
Well, I'm looking forward to giving it another try, because I think there's more to it than we all felt like at the time. Because even I thought he was a little corny. But then again, I thought Nort was corny too, and I've surprisingly enjoyed all the Nort stuff I've read since revisiting. I was shocked at that, actually. So, all right. So you can find more of him. At this point, he was in Justice League International Annual number 5, the just came out, which was the Armageddon 2001 crossover, and he's also and featured in Justice League America number 52 at the same time, which was the boxing issue. Up next, Captain Atom, revised entry. And you do get a modern version and original version first appearances. And you know, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail of it, but it turns out, you know, he's a military guy who got in trouble with the law and was basically framed for a crime. He was going to be executed and opted instead to be part of the Captain Atom Project, where then they zapped him with a – you know, put this alien armor on him and zapped him full of energy, and it ended up transporting him to the future by 20 years. And well, during these 20 years that had passed, the general that he doesn't like ended up marrying his wife, adopting his kids. His wife died. All this stuff happens. But in the end, the government basically says, Captain Atom, you have to work for us, or we're going to reinstate the charges and execute you. So he has no choice but to continue to work for the government, and at this point is very much a government stooge. Captain Atom is only on issue number 6 at this point. And check this out. Under group affiliation, it actually says Justice League International.
Which is a couple months ahead of time.
Right. And everybody else says Justice League at this point. In the same issue, says Justice League. His says Justice League International, which is fascinating. Because I don't think he actually joined till issue 7 anyway.
Right.
So they're planning all that out very nicely. Now, it's funny, you know, he's a military guy who volunteered for a government experiment, which gave him powers, and now he's a man out of time, and he's called a captain. Sound familiar? Now, here's something else to think about. All right, so follow the logic here. Captain Atom was created in the 60s, right? In real world, comic book. And then in 1986, Alan Moore writes Watchmen.
and adapts the character of Captain Atom into the character of Dr. Manhattan, right? In Watchmen, when Dr. Manhattan gets created, he gets zapped, he dissipates, and then months later, he reforms into a human body, right? Well, this version of Captain Atom, which was written a year later, is kind of similar. He gets zapped, he disappears, and has to reform his body later. So is this like a snake eating its own tail, where Captain Atom inspired Dr. Manhattan, and then Dr. Manhattan inspired Captain Atom?
Yeah, I don't know. I never thought of that before, but you're right.
I didn't think about it either until I was reading this, so I realized this was 1987, after Watchmen, because I don't think the previous Captain Atom had a time jump like that, or I think they call it a, I don't think they quite call it quantum leap, do they? Do they actually call it quantum leap?
I don't think so.
Quantum jump, I think is what they call it. Anyway, lots of things to say about this version of Captain Atom. I love him from the 80s. The Captain Atom series itself wasn't always my favorite, but I love the character. I love his appearances. I love a government representative superhero out there who's kind of screwing over the hero sometimes by reporting on him. So I dug the character, and I dug his place in the DC universe at this point. Oh, art by Pat Broderick, by the way. Firestorm extraordinary artist. Should have mentioned that. He's sort of standing very stock still with his
he
arms.
He looks like a greeter at a casino.
Yeah, well, his arms up, like, yeah, like he's saying, hello, welcome to the Quantum Nugget. In the background, you see him, you see General Eiling, I think it's him, with sunglasses on. You see him becoming energy, you know, fighting Plastique, Firestorm villain, General Eiling, Dr. Megala, and then you see him flying across the sky. And by the way, there's this whole thing in here I should have mentioned too, where I love that they gave him a fake origin. They basically said, you know, they didn't tell the public that he had come from the past, from the 60s to the 80s. They said, oh no, he's been a hero for years. He's been doing all these black ops missions. You haven't heard of him, but he's a real American hero, which is great. What a great idea. I love that. So it makes for a good idea, good sort of, you know, intrigue, subterfuge type stuff.
So, yeah, next up is Catherine Colbert, or Colbert? How do you say it, Chad?
Well, there's no L, so it's Colbert.
Okay, Colbert. Catherine Colbert, a supporting cast character from Justice League International, or Justice League Europe. She first appeared in Justice League Europe number one.
No shit!
Okay.
You keep going. That's in my commentary.
Drawn by Terry Austin and Al Williamson. Chad, this is right up your alley. This is one of your, like, favorite characters, right?
I absolutely have the hugest crush on this character. However, let's just talk about the art for a second. Though Terry Austin, Al Williamson, I adore both of them. Terry Austin is an amazing inker. Al Williams is an amazing penciler. They got them in the wrong order on this drawing, because they've got Terry Austin penciling and Al Williamson inking. It's the drawing is conceptually, the drawing is adorable, because what you've got is her doing her sort of her LinkedIn picture for the JLI. she's there with her coffee cup and she's smiling, and you actually see like a Polaroid says take one, and then it backs up and you see immediately after the picture is taken, Power Girl's disgusting cat has sliced her leg and she's spilling coffee and her nylons are run, and it's kind of funny, but it just, the drawing didn't come together. But regardless of that, the character, she's absolutely wonderful. I like how, as you read the entry, I don't know if you spent the time reading it, because I know you don't read these things normally, Rob, but they talk about, you do get a little bit of a sense for who she is, because they talk about how she was rich and she had this modeling career, but she wanted to prove herself, so she actually goes to work and tries to find a job where she can't rely on her money or her looks. She goes to the UN. She succeeds because of her brilliance, and she is a leader. That's what I love about this character. She's a fully realized non-superhero character that is incredibly important to the team. And you know, throw in the fact that she's beautiful. She's the whole package, man. She's amazing.
According to her listing, she's 5'10", 115.
Yeah, not really. No,
no
way.
No.
But it's a cute, the image is a cute setup. It is. I didn't feel like it came together. I like the insets, actually. I like where she's fighting with her foil. She's she was fencing with Metamorpho, and she's carved a Z into him, much like Zorro. Then you got her trying to separate Wally West and Elongated Man as they're bickering. And I love the character. She's got the blue border for supporting cast. Honestly, she could have been hero, but that's just me. Written by Kevin Dooley, who was editing, assistant editor of the JLI books at this point. And JLE, Justice League Europe, was on issue number 32 at this point.
Now, you said she did not first appear in Justice League Europe number one?
Thank you. Thank you so much for reminding me. Yeah, Justice League Europe number one is completely incorrect. And once I say it, you're going to go, oh yeah, of course. She actually appeared in Justice League International number 8, the Moving Day special. Because in that issue,
that's right.
Boom. Oh, see, I told you. Exactly. Because they go, because Beetle and Booster go over to the European embassy and they meet her in Paris, and Booster hits on her, fails miserably.
Right. That's
and
right.
That is actually the moment where the Bwahaha was invented for that joke, is where it came from. So she's actually responsible for the creation of the Bwahaha.
I remember that moment because Booster's like, watch this. And then
exactly.
Him walking away in shame. Yeah.
Exactly. That's why the joke works so well, is you don't even see him get shot down. You just see him come out, you know, afterwards. Oh, that's brilliant.
Yep. Oh, wow. Okay. All right, next up is Metamorpho,
dun, 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 dun.
One of my favorite characters, drawn by Mark Nelson, who am I completely unfamiliar with.
He, at this point, for Nexus, Airboy, Aliens, a lot of independent stuff.
Oh, okay, I read some Airboy, too. All right.
And the reason he's maybe affiliated this was because for DC, he was actually inking Pat Broderick on the covers of the Green Lantern issues, not the interiors, just on the covers.
Hmm, okay. One of the things I like about this entry is that it feels like it's the middle of a story we haven't read. I like that. I like that because we see Metamorpho in this sort of like ancient crypt, and we see that he's changing his hand into kind of like a jackhammer, sledgehammer type shape. And then we see in the bottom corner like a little tentacle of some creature writhing up out of the shadows. And so it feels like, yeah, this is a, you know, page three of a Metamorpho story we're never going to get to read. So
Indiana Jones-ish, almost.
Yeah, very Indiana Jones. So I dig it. And on the back, we see him finding the orb, which transforms him into Metamorpho. And then we see him with his supporting cast, where I'd say Mark Nelson went a little crazy with some of the anatomy, I would say. Java looks a little much. He looks like Mr. Creosote from Monty Python, but other than that, well, I think it's fun.
Go back and look at the way Ramona Freyter drew him, and Ramona Freyter drew Java pretty crazy.
Yeah, but hers was way more cartoony, and I feel like it works here. He's kind of going for like more realistic kind of thing. I don't know. Doesn't totally work on me, but it's fine. First appearance was Brave and the Bold, number 57, of course, drawn by Ramona Freyden. As you mentioned, he's a character creation of Bob Haney. Zany Bob Haney.
Woo!
First appeared in December 1964, January 1965. This is one of these characters that's like, you know, never been a big hit, but DC has gotten a lot of use out of over the decades. He was potentially going to get his own cartoon series in the 60s. He, of course, appeared on a Power record. He had that famous song. He was in Wednesday Comics, where he was drawn by Mike Allred, and he's been a member of The Outsiders. So he's always been around. And, he was the most famous, probably the most famous, certainly the first superhero to tell the Justice League no.
Yep, that was a big deal. Now, interestingly enough, though, at this point, he is known for being part of the Justice League because he's part of Justice League Europe at this point, which I think helped give him a lot of exposure. Even though, interesting, look at a group affiliation. No mention of Outsiders.
No.
Now, they're mentioned in the text, but they're not mentioned in a group affiliation. I think that's just a miss. But I think Justice League really gave him a big boost because he stayed a member of the Justice League for a long time because he starts with Justice League Europe, which eventually becomes Justice League International, which is very confusing. And then he moved over to Justice League America. So he was on there with, like, Wonder Woman and people like that, so that was a big deal. And he sort of stayed in the public consciousness ever since. He's died a bunch of times, but he always seems to be around. Now, maybe in the last few years he hasn't been around as much since the whole rebirth, not rebirth, the new 52 stuff, but before that he kind of was hanging around somewhere at almost all times.
Yeah, so, he's never far.
Interesting character. I really think the powers of weapons are kind of selling him short here because he can just about do anything he wants.
Yeah, he only gets two sentences. He can transform himself into any combination of chemical elements and can shape those elements into virtually any form. Well, geez, that's kind of a big deal, isn't it?
Right, exactly. So at this point, Justice League Europe was on issue number 17 where they're fighting the extremists. So a lot of big action going on there. And of course, one of the big things in the story too is they talk about how Metamorpho now has a son, but he's separated from his son because Stag, of course, being Stag is keeping Rex from seeing his son, things like that. So for more on Metamorpho, you should check out again. What's that?
I had something else I wanted to say about it. There is a line, it's in the final paragraph, where it says, Metamorpho has learned to deal with his inhumanity in a self-deprecating manner. Despite his easygoing demeanor, he has a formidable temper, but he exhibits blah, 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 blah. I thought it was interesting that this is written by Mark Waid, by the way, when they mention his inhumanity, because to me, humanity is not a physical construct. It's a quality of being. You know what I mean? And so to me, to the fact that his body is not a typical human body doesn't make him inhuman. And I know that was just kind of – that's the whole shtick of the character is that he's more than human or differently than human because, as you mentioned, he can die. He can blow. He can turn into gas form. He can do all these sorts of things that the regular people cannot. But I just thought that was interesting because, to me, I never thought of him as not having humanity. You know? He's always a very kind soul. So it's just – can do lots of crazy stuff.
I think probably then it's just a poor choice of words on Mark Waid's part, because what they're really trying to convey is he was sort of a Ben Grimm character where he was transformed into this beastly looking form and was always trying to figure out a way to transform back. Whether you read The Old Brave and the Bolds, which I just read one recently with Metamorpho, which was awesome, where he's getting transformed back with the Metal Men, or in Justice League Europe, he's, you know, trying to be a father and all this stuff. He's always trying to transform back to being human, sort of like Ben Grimm. So I think that's really what they're trying to reference, but maybe didn't get it.
Right.
And he had a tough conversion, really, if you think about it, because he was a humor comic. I mean, he started off as a straight up goofy superhero comic. It was intended to be funny, you know, and it was a big hoot. We did the first issue special and had an absolute blast with that thing, laughed our butts off on it. And then they transitioned into the main DC universe. So you get to Outsiders and they have to, you know, deal with that there, and you get to Justice League and they're dealing with it further. So he had a tough go of making him a little more mainstream, I think.
Okay, next up is The Flash, or here, as it just says, Flash. To me, it's The Flash, but okay. Drawn by Greg LaRocque and Jose Marzan Jr., text by Mark Waid, back to the Mark Waid love. Of course, his first appearance was as Kid Flash in Flash number 110, first series, December 1959, and then his first appearance as Flash was in Crisis on Infinite Earths number 12, in that little panel where he's like, I am Flash now! He's 6 feet, 175 pounds. The marquee character of the book, as I said, on the inset, we see him with all the supporting characters, and then we see him with we see him as Kid Flash, and then Barry Allen as Flash, and Jay Garrick as the Golden Age Flash. My one quibble with this listing is the drawing. It's great. I mean, the anatomy, everything else, Greg LaRocque, great artist. But he ain't running. He's flying.
What?
He's flying.
Oh, he's running.
He's flying. Look at that.
No, you're just catching. It's a like 800 speed film, and he's got his leg lifted. He is running. Now, his arms are back. I'll give you that. But he's clearly running. You see the smoke on the ground. He's just an inch or two above the ground. No, you're just being silly. This image is totally boss. In fact, Greg LaRocque is not even this good. I'm sorry, folks. Greg LaRocque, I love him as an artist. Sorry for those of you on Legion who just got upset. I loved him on Flash, but his art was always just okay. Like, if you look at the backside, especially like the little inset pictures, you know, like his class photo, it's okay. It's not great. You see what I'm talking about? The cover,
like,
stuff, it's fine. It's perfectly serviceable, but it's not amazing. The image of Flash running, though, the cover image is amazing. He's exploding at you. He's going so fast. It looks great. I love it. They've got the lightning in the background, which, you know, of course, is associated with the Flash. Wow. I love this image. Love, love, love it.
All right.
Now, at this point, Wally's, as I mentioned, his series wasn't selling that well. And Wally was kind of a lost spirit. They really didn't know what to do with the character. When they first launched the Flash book, he was doing heroic deeds for financial gain. By this point, he'd become known as a womanizer. Part of that was coming from the Flash comics. Part of that was coming from Justice League Europe, where he was a complete lech to Power Girl every issue. They introduced this kind of corny thing about where supposedly – because he kept losing his powers, right? And a psychologist convinced him that he had a mental imprint, that Barry had mentally imprinted on Wally, that if he ever used his powers irresponsibly, they would go away. I mean, they were really trying here, but it really was going to take Mark Waid to make this thing work. So they really were not hitting all thrusters. Again, 2 months away from the Flash TV show starting. Bill Mestrelopes was writing it at this point. I don't know if you've seen, there's a news articles going on around right now about
Bill Mestrelopes. I was glad you were about to. I was hoping you were going to mention that, yes.
Very sad situation. He's really having a hard time. He's lost an arm. Him and his wife have been lost two houses now for various reasons. There's a lot of articles. You should go out there and read them. Just kind of puts your life in perspective, puts his life in perspective. I haven't seen any like GoFundMes or anything for him yet. I imagine somebody will start one up fairly soon. But just, you know, be thinking about what's going on with this man who brought us a lot of joy over the years with some great comic books. And I sound like I was bagging on him just then. I wasn't. I'm sorry if it appeared that way. I did love these issues of Flash. He wrote some amazing issues of Flash. Anyway, so just keep him in your thoughts, folks.
He also wrote a great comic named Journey, by the way, an independent comic, which I read as a kid, and it was one of those first comics that, like, I didn't understand it much at all because it was just to me above me, but I really liked it, and he drew it, and he's really a great writer and artist, and absolutely, yeah. Check out there must be some sort of GoFundMe page starting soon, as you just said, so keep him in your thoughts, everybody, because this is the being creative in this world, not easy.
Right.
Not easy. Right. So, and he did a lot of great work. So anyway, but yes, the Flash listing, I don't mean to be too harsh on it. I know it's probably hard
that these listings are, by their nature, vertical, and that's hard to have somebody running when you're doing a vertical, you know, when that's the angle that you've got to work with. When we see down at the bottom, you know, you're doing a more horizontal panel, we can get more of the three people running and stuff. So I don't mean to be too harsh on this listing. It certainly is. The colors look great, and the logo is cool, and we see the lighting, as you just said. So, yeah, it's pretty good.
I guess if he'd had one arm cocked, like, you know, like you do when you're running, maybe it would have been a little better. But yeah. Everyone write in the comments and tell Rob that he's freaking crazy. This looks great. So,
okay.
Well, Flash was on.
Paste that from other comments, people.
That's true. I'll even start it for you, folks. Flash was on issue 42 at this point, heading screaming towards issue number 50, which was a great buildup to a Vandal Savage storyline. And when where Wally finally stepped out of the shadows of Barry and got his own costume, you know, which was slight alteration. It made it real red. It was real shiny. The white eye inset. So that was Wally's look for the 90s. So coming up real soon here.
Power Girl, drawn by Bart Sears, text by Robert Greenberger once again. This is one of those things where, unfortunately, at the moment that Power Girl gets a listing in Who's Who, she's in the costume that, like, I don't think anybody likes. Is this the version? Really? People like this yellow creamsicle costume?
The guy you're talking to likes it, because I know you call – I was waiting. I have it written down in my notes. It's not an omelet, because I know you like to call it the omelet costume because it looks like an egg white or whatever. But no, I think Bart Sears demonstrates here, this is actually supposed to be silver and gold, I think is what, rather than yellow and white. I think it's supposed to be silver and gold is what she's actually wearing. I think, and like, if you look in the inset, I love the thing around the neck, like the mock turtleneck kind of thing she's got going. I think it looks really, really sharp, because if you look at Power Girl, right, her history, and we're way off on fashion now, but, you know, when Wally Wood first started drawing her in All-Star Comics, he, and Jerry Conway confirmed this, he, every issue, he just kept drawing her boobs bigger.
Right.
To the point where they wanted to see how far they could go.
Right.
And that's why Power Girl is so overly endowed, because Wally Wood was having fun. That's why Power Girl looks ridiculous. And they just have run with it since then. In fact, the entry refers to her healthy physique at one point in here. So what's the right answer? Do you leave her with the boob window, which is, you know, I get why they do it in story, you know, it's to distract the guys, or she hasn't earned the S yet or whatever. There's different things, but I don't know. It's not female empowering. Is it? Well, I guess some people could argue that it is, but either way, it just seems like it's an inappropriate way to treat a female character is sexually objectifier. So instead, put her in a costume that covers everything. So in this costume, everything's covered. The yellow as gold and silver, it looks pretty sharp together. I like this costume. In the wrong hands, it's not drawn very well by a lot of artists. But I think in Bart Sears' hands, I think this costume looks fantastic here.
Okay, fair enough. I just, you know, to me, this feels like the Black Canary, that you know.
The Jazzercise.
The Jazzercise costume. Like, it's just
I like
the one
that costume too, by the way.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, in the inset, we see her in the classic suit. She's flying towards the camera. We see her with Arion, of course, because that's her grandfather, because, of course, her origin had to be retconned because he's not connected to Superman anymore. I love in the panel where she's getting surgery, Superman's in the background. He looks like he is as wide as he is tall. Like,
that's true.
He is just massive. He looks like a Masters of Universe figure. I mean, just Bart's going completely bonkers. I know I harp on this, but, like, again, her height and weight, 5'7", 140.
Okay.
No girl with boobs that big weighs 140 pounds. Like, your frame cannot support that.
I talked to my wife about this last night.
Okay, all right.
I asked her. I said, all right, help me out here. You know, a physically fit woman, you know, bodybuilder style, you know, 5'7", how much do you think? And I said, I didn't even show her the picture. I'm like, how much do you think she'd weigh? And she sat there and said, maybe about 145. I was like, really? She's like, yeah. I'm like, I find that hard to believe, but that's the number she came up with.
Okay,
so
all right. We're gonna have to
really
focus test this. We can talk to Cindy. We can talk to Liz. We can talk to the Ohamu girls. We need to find this stuff out.
It doesn't seem like a realistic weight, but yeah. I mean, the point my wife is making is like she doesn't. You know, if you're a bodybuilder, you don't have an ounce of fat on you. You're completely lean. You're very, very skinny. But you know, but muscle weighs more, doesn't it? Or is that a myth? I don't know.
Plus, but if you have giant, all right. I don't want to get on this, but like, if you have a giant chest.
I don't know. How much does a boob really weigh?
Well, but I mean, you can't be bone thin, and you can't not have an ounce of fat on you and have giant breasts. That's not the way that works.
You can't if Wally Wood creates you.
Well, right. Because Wally, yeah, that, and that's why. That's why they didn't let Wally Wood generally do comics, mainstream comics in the 70s.
But the inset pictures, by the way, really try and hammer that home, too. The one where she's flying at you with all the cleavage and the one where they're about to operate on her. Like, the ridiculous mounds that they've had to cover with sheets as they're about to operate on her is sort of silly. But I do like that they did something smart here. A couple different things. One, it was this is the depowered version of Power Girl, which they did in Justice League Europe because they kind of looked at it and said, okay, we can't really have another Superman-level character out there. So they depowered her. They had her get injured and brought it down, which is, I thought was a smart move. The Atlantis stuff, I get why Paul Kupperberg did it. I wish he hadn't. I've said it before. I really think the right answer for Power Girl would have been just make her a Daxamite. That would have been the right answer. In fact, you could have even said in Post-Crisis that she replaced Superboy in the Legion of Superheroes. She went to the future and she filled that role. That actually would have worked really, really nicely as a patch for the Legion stuff. Anyway, I guess, you know, I wanted to mention too, you know, she runs a computer company. Did you notice who her employee is in the computer company?
No.
Felicity Raymond, formerly Felicity Smoke from Arrow.
Oh, okay.
For those of you who get all excited and you're like, Felicity, really? The super hot girl from Arrow? Well, this is when she was a middle-aged brunette. But anyway, she married Ed Raymond, Firestorm's dad. So this is actually, you know, working for Power Girl is Felicity Smoke, Firestorm's stepmother, which is super cool. Now, again, the Atlantis thing is very unfortunate, but thankfully in 2005-ish, Geoff Johns sort of straightened all that out during Infinite Crisis, and he basically said, you know what? Screw it. She's from Earth 2. And retcon, you know, and said basically, yeah, this whole time she's just from Earth 2 where she was supposed to be from, which was very nice of him to do. At this point, Justice League Europe was on issue number 21. Up next is the Elongated Man. Woo! Ralph Dibny, we love you, sir. And, of course, he's got Sue there with him. Art is by Carmen Infantino and Bart Sears. What an interesting combination.
Mm-hmm.
Especially Carmen Infantino in, you know, 1990 was a very stylized style. And Bart Sears, of course, was drawing him in Justice League Europe. So it's an interesting combination that I think works pretty well. I don't know. So you've got Ralph running, and every part of him is stretching. His legs are coiling. His neck is coiling. His arms are coiling. His left arm is not coiling. But it's like really extended. Sue's in the background, hands on her hips, just looking cute as a button. And then behind, the whole background is red with, I don't know whether those are supposed to be parking spaces. I don't know what that design
is. It's just a design element, yeah.
So I think it's a nice piece.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. I like the idea of combining, as you mentioned, Infantino near the end of his career, his stuff got super duper stylized. So I think sort of brought in fan favorite Bart Sears to kind of like give it a more modern sheen. But I like that they got the original artist to do the listing. I think this is kind of a perfect compromise of wanting to do something that pays tribute to the original conception, but giving it a more modern look. So I think it's a really sharp combo. It's not a combo I ever would have thought would have worked. But
right, yeah. I mean, those are not two styles you think would go well together.
No.
But it works.
No.
Also, Ralph's wearing my favorite costume of the Elongated Man. I know it's not your favorite, but the one from Justice League Europe, it's half purple, half white with the EM across the chest. Always love this design. It's Stephen DeStefano, if I remember right. Or,
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know if I said his name right there or not. But I absolutely love this version, so it makes me happy in all kinds of ways. Important things to know about Elongated Man, of course, is his public identity. The world knows who he really is. He took a fascination studying India rubber men who were in carnivals, and I don't know if it's PC to say that anymore. But anyway, he studied them, and he found out all of them drank Jingold soda. So he took an extract of Jingold root and used it to transform himself and ended up with all these stretchy powers. And, of course, he was in Central City, and he became best friends with the Flash, which is great. Then he meets Sue, who would later on go to become his wife, and she's his debutante. Now, they talk about him joining the Justice League. There's no mention specifically of Justice League Detroit, which I understand isn't necessary. They cover it by saying Justice League of America. But it sort of makes me sad because that was really the first time Sue became a very big character in the Justice League era. So I feel like that could have got mentioned. Makes me sad. And then, of course, they talk about Justice League Europe, which is what Elongated Man's part of that team now. And then they got to the part where I was like, I'm just cruising along. I'm super enjoying this thing. And I even wrote down here, nothing bad ever happened to Sue.
That's right.
I wrote that down. But then they get to the part that just broke my heart, where they talk about Elongated Man's love for puzzles is so great that every year on his birthday, Sue surprises Ralph with a custom-tailored mystery.
which is adorable and sweet, except it leads you right to remembering Identity Crisis, because that was the whole setup for that thing. And it just, ugh. So I go back to nothing bad ever happened to Sue. We'll just keep saying that.
I had my mind wiped of that series, so I don't know what you're talking about.
Zatanna did that for you. Now, they talk about his detective skills. I'm a little bummed because the detective skills, I feel like, should have been under powers and abilities or powers and weapons. I know it's not a superpower, but it's really, you know, that's where those kind of things end up, is under powers. So, because, I mean, they talk about how great his detective skills are. I don't know that they really play them up enough, because as far as I understand, Ralph is like either the greatest or the single greatest detective in the world, you know, right there, either equal to or just below Batman, depending on who's writing the story at the time. So I feel like that really should end up her powers. And there's no mention of the nose twitching. What's up with that?
Again, they had the space for it. I'm glad you mentioned the detective thing, because my favorite moment, I think, ever of the Elongated Man, well, outside of JLA number 200, of course, is in JLA 218, where they're trying to track Professor Ivo, and Ralph comes up with, like, he studies all the information they have, because Ivo sent these robots out to kidnap athletes, and he, like, does this triangulation, and he figures out that the plot is to steal people of enormous physical ability. Okay. And the rest of the Justice League is like, wow, Ralph, that's a really great piece of detective work. Good job. And he gets this thought balloon, and it's, of course, this is right after Batman left the team to form Batman and the Outsiders. And he has this thought balloon, and you even see a silhouette of Batman in the background where he says, you know, all these years I've been on the team with Batman, I've always been sort of circumspect about playing up my detective abilities because I felt like I was in the shadow of Batman. But now that he's gone from the team, I feel like I can offer the Justice League a lot more. Hmm. And that's like such a great little moment. And unfortunately, like, it really never got followed up on, because right after that was like the Beast storyline, and then of course JLA Detroit, and they just never quite got back to that. But I love that little detail, that I think that's such a great human moment, that he's a great detective but he's not Batman, and being on the team with Batman made him doubt himself. I thought that was such a great, and that's courtesy of Jerry Conway. It's a great little moment.
That's fantastic. Oh, I love this character so much. I mean, he is Max, this one's for you, buddy. He's Plastic Man plus two, as far as I'm concerned. He's that good. So I absolutely love this character. It makes me so happy. Now, at this point in Elongated Man's time period, Justice League Europe number 23 was on the shelves, which was the Who is Crimson Fox issue, where they delve into her backstory. And of course, I should have said Mark Waid wrote the entry, and the border is red for Hero. And first appearance is Flash, the first series, 112. Wow, 112, that's really early in the run. I didn't realize that, because didn't Barry, like, when the Flash series, when Barry took over the Flash title, he didn't start with number one. He started with like 100 and something, didn't he? When
105, yes.
Yeah.
So this is 1 year in, they had the Elongated Man.
Wow, yeah, 1960. I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yep.
All right.
Next up is Rocket Red.
Woohoo!
Drawn by Bart Sears.
Woohoo!
I won't say, he was a former instructor at the Joe Kubert School when I was there. I never had Bart. My friends did. I just didn't have him, so I don't call him my former instructor, even though him and I crossed paths numerous times. Okay, the one detail.
Don't.
What?
Only talk positively about this, or I will salt your yard.
Oh, wow, that's weird. Okay, the one detail, though, I think is very funny, is it says, okay, it gives height and weight, right? Dimitri, his height is 6'7", 7'9", in the armor. Okay, weight, 235 pounds, 377 in the armor. That giant suit only weighs 140 pounds.
That's because it's apocalyptic armor.
Oh, sure, of course. Okay, fine. All right, I'm not buying that. Anyway, the drawing of Rocket Red looks terrific. Bart Sears is, Bart loved to get into like metallic modeling. He was big on tones and sheen and stuff like that. And Rocket Red is perfect for that, because there's like 4,000 little reflections of things going on as he's blasting all these different things going around. And then
it's definitely high polished chrome.
Yes.
Definitely.
And then we see him with his family, and then him blasting things with his powers, and then him with the Justice League Europe, I guess. Yeah, he's with Justice League Europe, because you see there with Power Girl and her ugly omelet costume and elongated man and stuff. So, but yeah, it's a nice piece.
It's a fantastic piece. The front piece is just freaking gorgeous. Now, I'm not the biggest fan of the Apocalyptian armor. I've never really loved it. I always loved the classic Rocket Red armor. I think the classic Rocket Red armor is like one of the coolest looking designs. So this one never really grabbed me. But tell you what, if someone's going to make me like it, it's going to be Bart Sears. Just love this piece. It looks fantastic. You've already described it, so I won't waste time talking about that. But this character's really grown on me more as I've been doing the JLI podcast. Because originally, he was fine. He was the jokey guy. He didn't really, you know, he was like the Yakov Smirnoff of, like, you know, the Justice League. He was, oh, look, funny Russian, ah-ha-ha. But the more I read about him, the more I interact with the listeners of the show and talk about stuff, the more I realize this guy is really interesting and really deep. Like, one of the things that I fall in love with as I read the Justice League comics is he doesn't take any of Batman's crap. Like, everyone is nervous around Batman. Everyone is cautious around Batman and cowards to Batman. Dimitri just talks to Batman like he's a regular dude. Like, there's scenes where they're just hanging out in there, and he's literally just talking to Batman like he's a regular guy. Him is probably Bat-Man or something. You know, he doesn't even think of Batman as the big scary guy, which I love. I never noticed that until someone pointed that out. Let's see. Lots of stuff to blaze through here. Okay, so there's a history. It's not just technically about him. It's about the Rocket Red Brigade, really, a little bit. They talk about, you know, how Kilowog helped create the Rocket Reds in those Green Lantern comics, and that was back in the Green Lantern Corps, in the first appearances, number 208 and stuff like that. And because that's actually when I first started reading Green Lantern comics. Those are some of the first ones I ever read. I thought the cover designs, they did like these sort of Soviet propaganda posters almost. They looked really cool with the Rocket Reds, and I picked those up, and I just fell in love with those issues. Anyway, talked about how Rocket Red number 7 turned out to be, you know, joined the Justice League, turned out to be a Manhunter. Dimitri's number 4. They don't mention this in here, but for you Firestorm fans, Mikhail Arkadin, who goes on to be one half of Firestorm, actually was in a Rocket Red armor for a while there. Well, he was trying to control his powers as Poser. Anyway, one of the things that does sort of jump out at me here is it talks about all the Rocket Reds are enhanced humans, and the suits are designed to regulate their powers. They talk about every single one of the Rocket Reds have enhanced strength, endurance, etc. Really? I see no sign of that anywhere in the Justice League comics so far that I've reread of Dimitri having any superpowers whatsoever. So I'll be watching for that, but I don't know that he's got these abilities that they claim he has here. I don't know. You already touched on Justice League Europe. You already touched on his family. There is a wonderful panel here of him and his family. Family was always so important to Dimitri. In fact, that's why he went to Justice League Europe, was because Maxwell Lord was able to get his family out of the Soviet Union into Europe. He wouldn't have been able to get him to America, but they could get him to Europe so he could be reunited with his family. That's why he joined it, which is great. They talk about here, too, how the Rocket Red Brigade was pretty much destroyed by the extremists, so he's kind of the last one. And they also say here, you know, he's sort of he seems like a simple guy. Who enjoys the domesticated life. You know, he always has his TV expressions are always mixed up and out of sorts. But they do talk about how he has don't cross him because he's also a fighter. And that's something we all kind of forget about, is that he totally kicked all the ass in those Justice League comics. So I love this guy. And I'm really just my passion for him is really, really grown. First appearances are all over the board here because, you know, as we said, you got Rocket Red number 1, then you get the Rocket Red Brigade, and you're assuming Dimitri was part of it. Anyway, right at this point, Justice League Europe number 19 was on the shelves at the same time this issue was, which was the finale of the big extremist storyline. So, also, and of course, the border's red, written by Kevin Dooley and Peter Sanderson, which is not, and it's not jokey, so I thought that was impressive that Kevin Dooley did that. And I love this one. In case you couldn't tell, I really like it.
Yeah, I think we know, yes.
Okay.
Right. Next up is Animal Man.
Animal Man.
Of course, first appeared in Strange Adventures number 180. Here it's drawn by Brian Bolland. And no surprise, it's a gorgeous piece of Buddy flying through the sky. And he's surrounded by a bunch of, I guess, flamingos. Are they flamingos? Or
yeah, pelicans? They're flamingos. They just haven't eaten enough shrimp because they're not all pink yet.
Okay, right. And then there's one solitary frog
flying
in the background, which is cool. I just like that. But I love the way he's just sort of gliding. He's not so much flying as he looks like he's almost like swimming in air, which I like quite a bit. And on the inset, you've got a family portrait. You see the big explosion. And then there's the final paragraph. This is written by Tom Veitch, by the way. The text is by Tom Veitch. And the final paragraph, it says, Animal Man is, as could be expected, a man of great compassion towards all creatures. He is an ardent animal rights activist, an environmentalist, and a vegetarian. Although he wears a mask, he goes to no great lengths to conceal his true identity. Now, aside from just all the sort of philosophical views that Buddy has that I will kind of line up with where I am. I like that this listing gives a perspective on who the man is, who the person is. There wasn't a lot of that in Who's Who. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, as you've talked about, Jack, there's all the Who's Who listings about, then he did this, then he went that, then right, he did, then he went to Earth 2, and then he joined the Teen Titans. I like that this listing, at least for one paragraph, just gives you a sense of who the person is. That's a nice little detail that I really appreciated they threw in.
Yeah, Tom Veitch really had a good handle on Animal Man, especially in the early part of his run, because, you know, it was Morrison, then Milligan did a short, like, six-issue run, and then Veitch took over for a pretty extended run. In fact, at this point, he'd been on with the book for a year. Like, when he started, I mean, out of the gate, I was like, oh, wow, this guy gets Animal Man. Now, it got pretty freaking crazy later, but at this point, though, he had a really great handle on the series, and it was really enjoyable. And I love, in the context of the text, if you read closely, they actually give you two different versions of Buddy's origin, and it basically tells you that we don't know. And what they're really addressing in there is Grant Morrison fiddling around with Buddy's origin and making it very meta as far as like the real world mucking about of a comic book writer versus what happened in the comic. And it builds the retcon into the origin. I just absolutely love that he did all that.
Yeah, it's cool. It's a really great list.
Talking about the art, though, I mean, that Brian Bolland piece on the front, Rob, I turned the page and it gasped, even though I've seen this thing clearly, but I just, oh my gosh, it's such a kapow moment. I mean, I actually, whenever I'm like, honey, you got to see this, I wouldn't show my wife, who doesn't care about all this. She's like, where are all the birds? I'm like, no, look how cool he looks. as Matt Evans said also recently on the JLI podcast, he said, you know, Animal Man has a really ridiculous looking costume. However, Brian Bolland has the ability to draw it so awesome looking. Like every Brian Bolland image of Animal Man, you look at it and you're like, man, that costume is awesome. Somebody else draws it and you're like, oh man, yeah, that's you don't even wear that to a costume party. That's embarrassing. But anyway, so going on to the entry, his first name is Bernhard? What? Or Bernard, I guess is how you pronounce it. I had no idea. All these years, it's just been Buddy. I didn't know that was his real name. And they also address it. At this point, he was on a sabbatical from Justice League Europe, which happened at the end of the Morrison run. And I like, you know, they talk a lot about the morphogenic field and stuff like that. Later, it's called the Red and all that stuff. But one of the coolest things that Veitch did, and I think it was Veitch, once the morphogenic field thing got rolling, is Animal Man was able to tap into the ability of extinct animals. Like, I remember this one issue where he's as a stuntman, he's driving a car off a cliff. He's like, okay, I'm going to get, like, I don't know, the stamina of an elephant and the strength of a Tyrannosaurus Rex. And I'm like, what? That's badass. And so they really did some interesting stuff with the character. So, you know, the writer, as we already said, Tom Veitch, the color is red. At this point, Animal Man was on issue number 42, which is about 1 year away from, actually, it's not right. We're still in the pre-Vertigo era. I didn't check out when that becomes, but we're still in pre-Vertigo. We're really close, though. And if you want more on Animal Man, check out those awesome DC Nation shorts, which is where Rob keeps getting his what?
Animal Man!
All right.
It's good stuff.
All right, up next is an entry that I thought I didn't have anything to say on. I really did going in. And I'm shocked at how much I've written down here. So I'll go through it fairly quickly. I don't have a ton to say on all the entries, but this one I did. It's Crimson Fox. And I'm like, really? I have much to say? Because the entry, the art's by Bart Sears, who helped introduce the character in Justice League Europe. She's a sort of a feral sort of creature. She's an all brown. And if you haven't seen her, just Google it. But there's nothing crimson on her. She's brown. And she's got long talon fingers. And she looks very aggressive and feral. And behind her is just a boring brick wall and some smoke. So what do you think of the art on this one?
It's by Bart Sears, Terry Austin. I mean, it's certainly dramatic. I think she has an incredibly goofy looking costume. That headpiece is just insane, but it, you know, it's pretty cool looking, and overall the design is nice. I love the logo. I feel like that had to have appeared on a Samantha Fox record at some point. It's got such an 80s font to it. We'll have to ask Zoom, since he's our resident Samantha Fox expert. But if she hasn't used it, she should have.
I like how the O has like little pointed ears like a fox.
Yes. Yep.
So the gist of this is Crimson Fox, and Rob probably doesn't know any of this because this all came out in an era when he hated comic books, but Crimson Fox is actually two people, identical twins, Vivian and Constance. And the deal of this is they are the heads of this super powerful corporation called the Revson Corporation in Paris, is they have all this powerful clout. And their origin is their mother was a scientist who was working on this experimental, very dangerous perfume formula. And unfortunately, it ended up killing her after the babies were born. And as these girls grew up and became the Crimson Fox, came into their powers, they took down the head of the corporation that was responsible for the mother's death, a guy by the name of Moriarty. If you're going to be named Moriarty, I mean, you just lean into it, I guess. And they decided, as the heads of this corporation, to fake Constance's death. So now the world thinks that only one of the twins is still alive, so that one of them can act as the corporate CEO while the other one's out there running around as Crimson Fox. And they can just switch back and forth when each one wants to do whichever. So Vivian is the party animal, and Constance is the very serious one. Now, their powers are they're very agile, they're very feral, they have leaping powers and healing, super sharp steel claws, they have pheromone powers, they have like a psychic connection, things like that. Ultimately, this character was just created to give the Justice League Europe a European member. Because up to that point, there was full of a team with nobody from Europe. You know, it was a little awkward going in there. So that's the gist. So I thought that was it. All right. But then I started realizing there's a lot of stuff here actually to talk about. Sort of interesting. First of all, you know, again, I told you there's nothing crimson on the character, right? So the character was originally called Le Renard Rouge, which is the Red Fox. However, the name now has been changed to Le Renard Rouge, which means essentially Crimson Fox. And the deal was there was an independent British black and white comic called Red Fox. All right.
Jeez.
I know, right? But who cares? You know who cared? A friend of the creators of the Red Fox. And that friend was named Neil Gaiman.
So ah.
Neil went and had a chat with the Justice League Europe editor, and all of a sudden the name was changed.
There you go.
So other interesting things is – another thing Crimson Fox is famous for is you know the James Robinson Starman series? Do you ever read that?
Yeah, I've read the first couple of trades.
Okay. Well, I don't remember what point where – I think it's in the 30s or so. But either way, they put together in one issue Jack's not even in it, I don't think. They put together a new Justice League Europe in this one issue. And the Mist, who's Jack's enemy, systematically tears the team apart and kills almost all of them. It's a really powerful issue, basically to demonstrate how dangerous the Mist is. And in that story, Crimson Fox dies, Blue Devil dies, and the Amazing Man dies. And it turns out – I've always been mad at James Robinson for that because Blue Devil is one of my favorite characters. Well, I found out in my research, it turns out that James Robinson just asked to kill Crimson Fox. That was it. And the editor actually said, tell you what, why don't you kill Blue Devil and Amazing Man too? We're not doing anything with them. So all this time I've been blaming James Robinson, and it turns out it wasn't his fault at all that Blue Devil died. Now, it's his fault that Crimson Fox died, but or at least one of them, but not Blue Devil. A few other interesting things real quick. She has actually gone on to be in other media. She's appeared in Justice League Unlimited, like as a background character. And she was in the show Powerless, which was that live-action show that went for like less than a season.
Exactly. Okay.
And then two more things, but still, but it's all this weird stuff about this character. My wallpaper on my home computer is the cover of JLA Avengers number 3. Remember that George Perez drawn JLA Avengers series?
Of course.
It was stunning. And the cover to number 3 is this amazing collage of pretty much every character from every era of both teams. It's amazing. It's been my wallpaper for years. Well, the way George laid it out, the very center of the screen is a collection of heroes sort of bursting out, and it's very symmetrical. And I guess using Crimson Fox made sense because there's two of them to be symmetrical. So she is dead square in the middle. So every single day when I go to log in on my computer, the box where you have to log in, it's Crimson Fox is right there. So I have to look at Crimson Fox every single day. So it's and here's the weirdest thing where it's all getting leading up to. I got a phone call just a few days before Rob and I recorded this episode out of the blue from my sister. All right. My sister, not a geek. She likes Star Trek, but she's not a geek. She gives me a call and out of the blue, she goes, hey, I'll start the Crimson Fox blog. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? Do you have any idea what she's talking about, Rob?
No.
On the very first episode, going back 8 years ago, folks, the very first episode of the Fire and Water podcast, you and I were talking about my Firestorm blog and your Aquaman blog, and we said just about every character in the DC universe had a blog except for Crimson Fox.
Oh, God. Oh, wow.
We took a shot at her on our very first episode, and apparently my sister discovered podcasts and decided to listen to our show, and so she called to tell me she would start a Crimson Fox blog. She's not really intending to, but she thought that was pretty funny, and it totally took me by surprise. So
that's baffling.
Isn't that crazy?
Yes.
So, all right, that was a lot of information about Crimson Fox that bored the blue mob, so I'm glad you made it through there. So at this point in history, you could find her over in Justice League Europe. It was on issue number 27 at this point in time, which is the one where Starro came to town. They had to deal with him. By the way, the text here is written by Kevin Dooley. We've already talked about the art. The border is red.
All right, let's move on. Blue Jay and Silver Sorceress, who first appeared way back in Justice League of America number 87, the original series, but then got brought back for JLI. Of course, Shag, you've been covering that. Here it's drawn by Bart Sears and Terry Austin. And we get a sense of how big Blue Jay is because we're in the foreground. We see a pencil. These are the alternate Avengers characters that were sort of that appeared in JLA as a sort of parody, and then they sort of really became their own sorts of things at this point. There was a third one. There was Wanjinda was the name is the third guy. And he died in Justice League of America. Or, I mean, Justice League International. What number 3? I believe. Does he die?
We thought he gave his life, but it turns out he lived for a little bit longer and then was corrupted by the Queen Bee. And I think he died around issue 16 or 17, actually.
Okay. All right. But I mean, so the Blue Jay and Silver Sorceress are the ones that survived. And they get the. And Blue Jay, as we see, is in the foreground. And he is, as drawn by Bert Sears, as usual, these people are muscled within an inch of their lives. He was like muscles on top of muscles. And so Blue Jay is so powerfully built, you wonder how he even has enough lift to get off the ground, even with the wings, because he's so. And yet, when you say he's weight 150 pounds, when he's using his power, he's only 3 pounds. So he's super cute.
Yeah, he's adorbs.
He's adorbs.
Silver Sorceress, very sexy in the background. No silver, but very sexy. To be specific, they are analogs for Scarlet Witch, and he's an analog for. Well, you can take your pick whether you want to be Yellow Jacket or Ant Man. Either way, that's their. Or it might even be a Scott Lang Ant Man. I'm not sure. Either way, to be specific about what you're saying about them appearing in JLA, it was that same month where Avengers had the Squadron Sinister,
right.
And the JLA writers agreed to have some Avengers analogs, and really, Squadron Sinister was the much better of that deal. Because there were a bunch more heroes of Angor. There was a Speedster, there was a Captain America, there was a bunch of different versions of them. Either way, these are the two that lasted. And at this point, they are actually on our Earth, and they've joined Justice League Europe at this point. So that was
sort of interesting. Don't take anybody.
That is fairly true. One thing to note, just because I pay attention to these kinds of things, previously the Silver Sorceress had an open stomach outfit. There was a cutout where her bare midriff was showing. They have apparently gotten rid of that here, and it's also gone on the inset, which I thought was kind of interesting because she had that for a long, long time. Under the first appearances, they really needed a current version indication, I think, because they really did. The appearance years ago in Justice League versus what they did with them in Justice League International. It's really very, very different. So I think they should have merited that. But I like the Bart Sears drawing. I think it looks great. I love the pencil for the reference. I think she's gorgeous and sexy in the background. I like sort of the effects going on. I dig it. And I think Blue Jay's costume looks pretty cool for a bird dude, you know? Anyway, text is by Kevin. Well, you only go so far. Text is by Kevin Dooley. Border is red for heroes. And at this point, they would have been appearing in Justice League Europe number 29, which is the breakdowns period of Justice League has started. Love it or hate it, it was pretty important in the Justice League International era. All right, up next is Kilowog. Oh, this is fantastic. Now, this is during an era where Kilowog didn't have any powers. He didn't have a power ring, so he's just a guy with his brain. So at this point, he was serving as the chief and mechanic for the Justice League International folks. So here he is fixing a whole bunch of machines, and he's in his overalls. This is from the JLI era. And the art here is by Larry Stroman and Scott Hanna, and I think it just looks fantastic. What do you think of this one?
Who is Larry Stroman? I'm completely unfamiliar with him.
Oh, gosh. I want to say he went on to be part of the Milestone line, I think.
Okay.
I could be wrong on that. I could be wrong, but that's where I knew his stuff in the 90s. Oh, if you hadn't put me on the spot. I've seen Stroman a lot, and I want to say that's where I know him from.
Okay. It's a great drawing. I think it's like the pose. I mean, like the situation of him just repairing something, kind of boring, but the drawing itself is terrific.
Yeah, it's absolutely great. And you're supposed to vamp just a little bit more so I can look up Larry Stroman.
I'm sorry. Okay. Well, the logo is pretty dull. It's just a typeface. Kilowog has managed to be, because he was in the movie and he was in the cartoon series. He's a late period Green Lantern, and yet he has really popped in terms of his overall pop culture, fame. First appeared in Green Lantern Corps number 201, and that was when the book converted from Green Lantern to Green Lantern Corps, and so he's become a thing. It's kind of amazing.
He really did become a big, big name. You mentioned the animated series, the movie, Justice League International. He's been on a lot of places. Now, okay, Larry Stroman. Here's the – I'm wrong. It's not Milestone Comics. I'm so sorry. But he – where I – it's X-Factor. That's where I knew him from. He drew the Peter David issue. Remember those amazing Peter David issues of X-Factor? No. Larry Stroman – well, maybe you didn't read them. I don't know. They're great. And Larry Stroman was the main artist on that. And he goes on to do a whole bunch of stuff. And he did a bunch of X-Men stuff and Punisher stuff and Dark Horse stuff. He does the Tribe for Image Comics. He had a really, really big, big career. And it looks like he has continued to work up through at least 2009, according to this entry I'm looking at here. So, yeah, great, fantastic artist. Oh, I guess he's – and he's still drawing. I apologize. So,
good for him.
So Kilowog, right. So he's this – he's basically designed to look like a warthog, folks. Okay? So if you hadn't figured that out, yes, he's supposed to look like a warthog. The name Kilowog, it's all kind of there. And he's from the Bolovax people who were this – they had this sort of this shared communal mind. And he was this brilliant genetic scientist, which is not what you really think of when you think of Kilowog. But anyway, apparently he was. And had really, really high willpower. So he became a Green Lantern. The crisis comes along, ends up wiping out his people. Sinestro then came along and made sure that they stayed dead when their ghosts almost came back. It was very sad. He comes to Earth and he goes to the Soviet Union because he likes their philosophy. He thinks the old communism idea is kind of similar to his race. And he helps them perfect the Rocket Red Brigade. So he's actually responsible for the Rocket Reds. Later on, he helps the New Guardians because, you know, everyone goes through a bad spell in their lives. And then later on, he ends up as the mechanic for the Justice League International. And that's where he is at this point. Again, he doesn't have the powers. And he's not even the drill sergeant sort of character he is that we all know him as. Is, you know, the really aggressive rah, 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 kind of guy from the Green Lantern stuff. That actually comes a little – that's a retcon that comes a little bit later. So at this point, he's more like a – I don't want to say gentle giant, but he's really, really nice. I mean, he can still say poozer and all that, but with the rest of them. But yeah, he wasn't the drill sergeant yet. Now, this piece is written by Kevin Dooley, who was, of course, editing all the JLI books. His border is red. And at this point, Justice League America number 50 and Justice League Europe number 25 were both on the shelves. And he was appearing in a lot of the Justice League books, whether it was in the background or as a main character.
All right. Next up is The Conglomerate, which is a super team led by Booster Gold, which first appeared in Justice League Quarterly number 1. Now, I bought Justice League Quarterly. I have no memory of this at all.
There it is.
None.
Everyone at home, you have your bingo card out, and go ahead and stamp the box that says Rob has no memory of these characters.
No. Boom. Well, I know Gypsy, certainly. Okay. But, I mean, yeah, I looked at this, and I'm like, what is this? I just have no memory of this at all, but... I don't know. I bought Justice League Quarterly. I know I did. So I don't know. This is supposed to just went in one eye and out the other or something like that. So why don't you explain to everybody what this team – first of all, it is a very 90s team because they all have very 90s names. Reverb, Echo, Praxis, Booster Gold, Maxi Man, Vapor, and Gypsy. That is very – they feel like they all belong to work at Empire Records or something. So this is
– yeah, it's very late 80s, early 90s. Absolutely. And it's corporate too. It's all about corporation. Basically what happened – I'm kind of surprised you don't remember, at least in their existence, because they were sort of the anchor in Justice League Quarterly for the first few issues, at least. You know, Booster leaves. He gets mad at the Justice League because they didn't take him seriously. I can't imagine why. And he goes out and forms his own corporate-sponsored team. In fact, they're all wearing jackets, and what you really can't see very well is the back have a bunch of corporate logos, like race cars. They have logos all over them, which is actually pretty clever, I think. You know, it's forward-thinking. I mean, people use that later on quite often. They used it in Squadron Supreme with the Speedster character and everything.
Mystery Man too.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and so Claire Montgomery is Maxwell Lord's ex-wife, and she's the equivalent of Maxwell Lord in this team. She's the brains behind the whole operation. So she works with Booster. They pull together all these characters. They pull together Praxis, who's actually rather interesting. He's kind of a mental-powered guy, and he was popular enough that he went off and had his own solo adventures for a while. I want to say his first appearance was actually in a Spectre comic, not here. I'll be honest. You're right. There are a lot of forgettable characters here, and I'll get to that in a second. You're right. Now, but the two important characters to mention on this team are Gypsy, which you already mentioned, and Reverb. Do you know who Reverb is?
It's the alt Vibe.
It's Vibe's brother.
Yep.
Yep, exactly. This conglomerate, honestly, was the beginning of the redemption of Justice League Detroit. Because Justice League Detroit was – everyone hated it at the time. They're like, oh, it's terrible. These aren't the real heroes. And Justice League International came along, and everyone thought it was funny and loved it, and everyone just bashed on Justice League Detroit. This was the first time I think DC ever took a stand and said, you know what? Justice League Detroit wasn't too bad. So we got Gypsy. We got Reverb. And Reverb – now, here's another thing. You know, we talk about live-action stars. Reverb could have been a TV star, believe it or not, because, you know, Flash has the – Cisco Ramon has the Vibe character on there, right? Well – in this comic, or in the DC comics, this character Reverb goes on to become Hardline, and then in New 52, he goes on to become a character called Rupture.
Of course he does.
Right, of course. Well, the Flash TV show has used Rupture in their show. However, what they did was they assigned it to a different Cisco brother, which is unfair. They assigned it to Dante rather than Armando. So technically, Reverb did not get into TV, but kind of did, if that makes any sense. Anyway, I think it went to Dante because that character was created by Jeff Johns. That's a whole different discussion there. So the sad thing about Reverb is no breakdancing. I mean, you know, you can't have everything, I guess. Now, the three other characters are Maxi-Man, Vapor, and Echo. And guys, you get to double stamp that box because I'm going to say I have no memory of these characters either. I haven't done a complete reread on Justice League International. I'm still working my way through it as we go with the podcast. So I'm going to discover these characters like everybody else. I can't remember them at all. So, I mean, I've read their entry here, but I got nothing. So I can't wait to read them, though. I'm very excited. And Justice League, and at this point, Justice League Quarterly number one had just come out. So this is very, very timely to have this entry in here. And of course, it's written by Kevin Dooley, who was the editor of Justice League at the time. So he did a lot of that. Art by Chris Sprouse. Did you mention that, Chris Sprouse?
No, I didn't. Chris Sprouse and Bruce Patterson.
I love Chris Sprouse. He's just got, his stuff always looks so fresh. You know, that's the word that always comes to mind when I think of it. So. First entry is Gray Man. This is the character from the Justice League International, or at that point, just Justice League book. He is a really kind of an interesting character. He's a cosmic entity who was brought in by the Lords of Order or Lords of Chaos. I forget which one. I think the Order. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. His job is to go and collect the leftover dream essence from the dead. What a cool power. And eventually, he wanted more power, so he ended up stealing dream essence from the living. And that's where he ended up facing off against the Justice League. Amazing artwork here, by the way, by Mark Beecham. Looks almost Sienkiewicz with the way he used shadows and lighting and blacks. I love the art. And you get
seems more Neil Adamsy to me, but
oh, you think so?
Yeah.
Okay, could be. I can see that influence. And but you get a two-tone surprint.
Mm-hmm.
Not you know, not something you see too often.
Yeah, it's a nice piece. I like that the logo is done entirely in Zipitone.
Yeah,
that probably wasn't terribly easy to do. It's interesting that they chose somebody whose art style was so diametrically opposed to Kevin Maguire.
Right.
And because that's where he first appeared in Justice League number two, which was a Kevin Maguire thing. They went completely the opposite of Kevin Maguire's sort of cartoony fun style and went with somebody really serious and kind of nasty looking.
You know, in Mark Beecham, this is the only time Mark drew the character. But what's interesting is they mentioned Sandman 2, which is the Jack Kirby, Hector Hall version of Sandman. But, you know, if you look at the way he looks here, couldn't you picture him in those early issues of Neil Gaiman's Sandman?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, and that was, you know, the dream essence that's right up that alley. So that would have been kind of an interesting thing. And I wonder if Grayman ever appeared in the Sandman. I read it, but it's been so many years, I don't remember.
I don't remember. All right, next up is Queen Bee, drawn by Bove and Rick Magyar. She's a new character from Justice League International, number 16. I think the surprint of the JLA is kind of meh. Her pose is good. What really is captivating is the surprint image of her. That is a really beautiful drawing, a very fashion kind of conscious-looking thing. I think it's a really, really nice piece. And it's funny because women are a lot harder to draw than men. But to me, the JLA here does not look great, but that portrait is almost, like, I would say stunning.
Well, it's interesting you should say all that because you're wrong. Hmm. First of all, I mean, yes, the portrait in the background is very nice. However, the front image, she's sexy as hell, man. She looks great. I mean, she's split. Because sex is what Queen Bee's all about. She is a sexual being. She uses her seductive womanlyhood all the time to get what done. So she is laying down.
Her seductive womanlyhood.
You like that? Yeah, yeah. I use the big words. And she's laying down and her dress is just draped and she's got her top. I don't know whether that's supposed to be lingerie showing through or that's just the top of the dress. I don't know which. But she's giving you bedroom eyes, you know, in that picture. And it looks great. And also, I think the JLA, the Justice League looks great. I love Guy Gardner's got that snarky smile that looks like Guy. Batman looks dead on model. Okay, Mr. Miracle, maybe not quite, but Blue Beetle and Mr. Manhunter, I think they look fine. And also, I think it's Bove. It's got an accent over the E, for goodness sake.
Okay.
Now, it's Steve Bove, by the way, is who it is. Isn't that the guy that drew that Aquaman letter thing for you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So he was a staffer, right?
Yes.
Okay. Because, yeah, Steve Bove does a few entries in this issue, and there's no reason for him to do any of them. He's not associated with anything that he drew. Like, when he did
Was it Parliament of Trees, I think it was, earlier?
No, he didn't do Parliament of Trees.
He did something earlier.
Oh, he did do Parliament of Trees. I'm sorry. Yeah, I was thinking.
Oh, look at that. That's me being right a lot and Rob being long. Mm. So for those of you keeping score at home. Anyway, he doesn't have any association with these things other than he's a staffer. So once again, logo is just a typeface for exact. And an argument could be made that this could be a revised entry. And maybe that's why maybe Puppeteers Revised was supposed to be over here. I'm not sure. Even though this Queen Bee is not even remotely related to the pre-crisis Queen Bee, there was a pre-crisis Queen Bee. I can't remember. Wasn't it Lana Lang, maybe? Wasn't that?
Who? No, that's Insect Queen.
Okay. But it was there was a Queen Bee. I looked it up today. There was definitely a Queen Bee in the pre-crisis stuff. And someone's screaming at their Zonaphone right now going, "Why do I know who it is?" I do take, like, where it says marital status single. Even though we don't know at this point, I totally suspect it probably should be Widower. She probably has like a string of dead husbands, I think. Just that seems like her style, you know, doesn't it? She's a great character. She was really good in the Justice League International stories. She's smoking hot. And at this point, she sort of shocked everyone because she murdered, what's his name, Harjavati, the guy in charge of Baele, or however you say that country, which I still can't say. And it was like shocking when he killed her, hit that guy, and took over the country. It was like, whoa! So, neat character that was really just being developed at this point. She first appeared in Justice League International number 16. And just to give you some, you know, perspective, only issue 18 is on the shelves right now. So she's only been around for two issues, really. And by the way, that issue 18, that's the one with Lobo on the cover. Like, they do the two Lobo covers where it's like Lobo over Guy, and the next issue it's Guy.
Yo, Guy over Lobo. Yeah.
So it's good stuff.
Next up is Despero, one of the big heavy hitters of the DCU, at least in his current incarnation, drawn in this case by Adam Hughes and Joe Rubinstein, a fantastic piece of him leading over a planet just sort of raging into the heavens with his ripped up cape. He first appeared, of course, in Justice League of America, number one, back when his fin went the other direction. he first appeared October, November 1960. He doesn't mention here, but he, of course, is the creation of Gardner Fox and Mike Sikowski. I love on the insets, we see kind of the three versions of Despero. The one is him as he first appeared, kind of in the, not as he first appeared, because we see Black Canary there. But I mean, it's him fighting the JLA in his original form. Then when we see him in the middle panel when he came back as kind of the more badass version, where the fin was painted the other way and he's torturing Batman on the he's got Batman like on the rack. And
that's
the
Justice League Detroit era, right?
Justice League Detroit era. And then third is him squeezing the life out of Blue Beetle. And I love the mood I get from that third one is that like Despero's breath is really hot, like it's having like a blow dryer on you because it just feels like really uncomfortable. It looks really cool. I mean, Adam, the issues of Justice League International or Justice League, what the hell is the book called at that?
It's Justice League America.
Justice League America, but the ones with that Despero are great. They are fantastic. And so this is, look, I'm an old fart. We know that. I love old versions of things. But I will say, I feel like this attempt to kind of toughen up Despero and make him more sort of palatable for a modern era, I think worked perfectly because it didn't chuck what they had done previously. He just moved it forward, and to me it kept a lot of what made the character still compelling and interesting and sort of fun to look at, but also made him a little less silly-looking and more in line with the era. So I think this is a great piece.
Yeah, it was a great reimagining. And honestly, it's all down to J.M. DeMatteis because he took Despero in those issues of – and you correct me if I'm wrong. I thought – oh, no, wait. That was Jerry Conway, wasn't it?
Jerry Conway.
J.M. DeMatteis took over a couple issues later. Yes. Oh, that's right. Okay. Well, the gist of it is it wasn't just a, hey, this is how he looks now. They actually put Despero on a quest to get this flame of Petar, which is what ended up transforming him into this new – well, the first step of the new form, which is, again, where you basically you make him taller, stronger, and you flip the fin. And then the Justice League International version was like the bulked up, almost gorilla-like version. I mean, he's just so enormous. And it was just an amazing transformation. Yeah, it made him a character that we actually cared about. And you already mentioned how great the JLI story was, which is great. I don't really have anything more to add. You really hit all the high points. So I can't wait to get to it when I get to those issues with JLI. Interestingly enough, J.M. DeMatteis in some of the interviews has talked about how when they did the Despero story, he didn't really see it as being this big, amazing story. He was sort of sending up these giant, you know, superhero pitch battles. He didn't realize it was going to be treated that way. Everyone, he thought that they were making fun of big superhero battles. Instead, all the fans reacted being like, "This is amazing!" So
it worked on me.
It worked on all of us. I don't know anyone that wasn't moved by me. Because Despero, I mean, what Despero was doing at one point, guys, he was his cape. He ripped the UN flag off and wore the UN flag as his cape, which just looked so awesome. Looked really cool. So anyway, Justice League International, or Justice League America at this point, was on issue number 42. They had just finished the Despero story. In fact, I think they were on the Requiem, you know, epilogue. So this is actually perfect timing for this entry.
One last thing I do want to mention. I love it. It says, Occupation Conqueror.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that fits him to a T, at least from the Flame of Petar days forward.
I wonder what your IRS tax code is on that when you pull it and put it on your 1040.
It's 666. It's,
yeah, something like that. Anyway, great listing. One of my favorite things. I'd love to see what Despero's parents looked like. It says unnamed parents. Boy, what do those two look like? Oh, boy.
Probably like a goofy first drawing.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah, it's a fin. Okay, great.
Next entry. And this is fun. This is fun. You probably read this and you didn't even know what the heck this was. The extremists, or extremists, however you want to say it. These are Justice League Europe villains, guys. And there's a lot to talk about here. And fair warning, if you're a fan of the Justice League International Blahaha podcast, which is a great show, by the way.
I heard Kyle Baker was on it.
Right. There is going to be some spoilers here. So fair warning for that. If you really don't want to be part of that, skip forward about 10 minutes or so. I would normally say 5, but I'm really excited about this one. So on the cover is you've got the five members of the extremists, or is it six? Five. You've got Lord Havoc in the front, who's wearing the big metal suit. You've got Dr. Die Hard in the back left hand. You've got Gorgon, who's this fat guy and who's got sort of these tentacles coming out of his head. You've got Tracer, who's on the ground looking all savage. And in the background, you've got Dream Slayer, who's really creepy, floating in the back. And they're standing on a mound of sand and dirt and dead skeletons. It's very creepy. And what this was in the Justice League International group, this was their first real effort to create new, really threatening bad guys. Because, you know, Justice League International is always, it was kind of a joke book, right? You know, it was supposed to be what was happening in between battles. Well, Justice League Europe was supposed to be more adventurous and have more, you know, action. And so they created a set of bad guys they felt like would be a real threat. And that's where this comes from. So here's the gist of it is, this group of villains, they're from another dimension. Let's be honest, it's a parallel Earth, but they couldn't say parallel Earth after Crisis, but they call it another dimension. Anyway, they're from the world of the Champions of Angor. You remember them with Blue Jay and Silver Sorceress,
sure,
and all that?
Yeah.
On that planet, there was a nuclear arms race, and the supervillains decided to end the arms race by basically taking control of all the nuclear weapons and to force the nations to abandon this fatalist, you know, race weapons they were in. Well, you know, they're bad guys, so power corrupts. So eventually the bad guys decided to use the weapons and threaten the world and to submit to their rule. Well, the world refused, and the villains actually unleashed all these atomic weapons on the Earth and just laid waste to the planet. Now the extremists have come to our Earth to do the same. And again, they're really just nasty. They're violent. They're cruel. They're into torture and stuff like that. Now, let me ask you, Rob, anything about these villains seem familiar?
You put me on the spot here.
I did.
Not particularly, no.
Okay. Here's the interesting – there's a lot going on here, okay? For starters, they're from the world of the Champions of Angor. Do you remember what the Champions of Angor were famous for?
No.
They were the analogs of the Avengers.
Oh, okay.
You know,
okay.
Blue Jay was Ant-Man and Silver Sorceress was Scarlet Witch and there was one Jenna was Thor and all that stuff.
Right.
So they're from the same world. So these guys – and I didn't even know this until a couple of years ago. These guys were analogs of Marvel villains. Lord Havoc is Doctor Doom. Dr. Die Hard is Magneto. Gorgon is Dr. Octopus.
Dr. Octopus.
Tracer is Sabretooth. And Dream Slayer is Dormammu.
Huh.
And so they wrote them as – I mean, they didn't treat them as a joke. They treated them seriously. They were scary villains. But again, it's sort of following the Champions of Angor idea. They based them on Marvel characters. Now, here's the big, 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 big reveal. Okay, so again, spoilers for you Justice League Europe listeners, folks. So again, I told you that they used all the atomic weapons, right, and wiped out the planet. Well, they killed themselves too. The extremists are dead. What happened was on that world is basically Disney World. They call it Wacky World. And they kept going. And so the computers, the systems of Wacky World created animatronics of the people on the planet. The last people alive are the extremists. So they created animatronics of the extremists. And they acted just like the extremists and came to our world. So it turns out, you find out at the end of this, these are things are all robots. And it takes like a sort of a Walt Disney-like character to get them to shut down. So that was the big reveal at the end of that, which was just really like a big shocker. So Now, to give you some perspective on the timing of this, when this issue of Who's Who's on the shelves, so's Justice League Europe number 20. They had just defeated the Extremis, so this is extremely timely. I mean, it was just last month when they finished defeating the Extremis, and it goes right into Who's Who. So that's a great way to do timeliness. You know, they sync that up quite well. So, and by the way, the art, I didn't say who does. Our Bart Sears did the art. So Kubert instructor Bart Sears. And on the back, it's got little inset pictures of every single character, and then there's an inset picture of everybody fighting the Justice League Europe folks fighting them. So let me, you know, stepping back from this, I know how much you love the 90s. What do you think of this?
Well, again, the listing makes no mention of the team's original name, which was the 1990s. That was the original name of the team.
It is the Extremis. It's right there in the name.
Yeah, this is another thing where reminded me of, I think, the first Who's Who that we did, the loose leaf, where I'm having a false memory, which is worrying me because I'm starting to wonder if I've been incepted or something. Because I have vivid memories of Justice League Europe number one coming out and everybody at Kubert being all excited and like showing, being excited because Bart Sears was an instructor, as you just said, and a bunch of my friends had him. I didn't have him as an instructor. And being all like, oh, wow, Bart, you're doing Justice League number – you're in Europe number one. But that can't be right because Justice League Europe number one came out in April of 1989, which is before we were at school. And even so, Bart didn't teach first year anyway. So the earliest anybody would have had him would have been September of 1990. So my memory of it being Justice League Europe number one cannot be right. It must have been a later issue of Justice League Europe.
He didn't stay around all that long.
Right, so I'm just remembering it wrong. I do think it's funny though, considering a conversation you had on JLI a couple episodes back, where you look at the inset shot and we see full body shots of Elongated Man and Metamorpho, Flash. But what do we get? A Power Girl butt shot.
That's true. That's true. It is a butt shot of Power Girl. That's funny.
So I mean,
they love their butt shots, don't they?
They love their butt. Ben Bart especially loves his butt shots. I like Bart Sears stuff a lot. It's very stylized and it's very extreme. You know, I mean, that was his style. But I actually think that he brought a lot of quality draftsmanship to it. And if you look at a lot of the DC comics in the mid 90s, you'll see a lot of people imitating Bart Sears' work without the talent behind it.
Yeah,
and there is some grim stuff. Some of it by actual Kubert students that were just copying Bart, frankly. But Bart had the goods. You know, I mean, this is really exciting. And the designs are very, very ornate and complicated. It must have been a pain in the ass to draw these guys regularly. So they probably didn't appear a whole lot because I would just be like, oh, geez, this is a lot of work.
Well, it's interesting. It's also sort of, you know, Keith Giffen's commentary on the extreme 90s as they were coming. I mean, he saw it coming in the writing on the wall. And that's part of what these characters are supposed to represent. So yeah, it's a nice big package. So all right, up next it's a fun one, folks. It's Manga Con by Joe Phillips. I love this one. You know, Manga Con, of course, is the crazy salesperson from Justice League International. The whole idea is it's basically a play on the home shop in an intergalactic home shopping network. And his character, I don't know if you know this or not, Rob, his character was actually based on Stan Lee, the way Stan Lee speaks and writes, and also combine that with the way Jeanette Kahn was. That's where Manga Con came from. And here on the cover,
Manga Con.
I keep saying it wrong, don't I?
Manga.
All right. So he's standing there, you know, very dramatically. He's got his arm raised. He's like, Elrond, let's barter till we drop. And Elrond, the robot's in the foreground taking notes. He says, you're shouting again, my lord, which is fantastic. It's gorgeously rendered. It is an absolute hoot because there's, you know, word balloons and it's funny. And Elrond's pen top is one of those little, puffy balls with wiggly eyes, which is adorable. I love this piece. It's gorgeous. What do you think of it?
It's okay.
What?
Yeah, I think it's okay. I don't know.
You are the worst.
Okay. All right. Weird that there's no creator credit. I would think that considering how recently he was created, that they would have that. But I don't know. This character never did a whole lot for me. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm not asking you about the character. I'm asking you about the drawing.
Okay. I don't think the drawing is all that great either. I don't know. There's just something about it. It just seems very – I don't know. It's just kind of like, it's all right. It's not particularly funny. I think visually it's kind of like he's all
okay. Shut up. Forget I asked. Just shut up. Okay. Anyway, so it's great, folks. It's drawn by Joe Phillips, who was drawing the Mr. Miracle series at this time. So that's why they got him to draw MangaCon. And the I hope you don't mind I shut you down there. Just you're I was going to start crying. The text
Can
is
we talk
by
about
Kevin...
John K. Snyder again?
We should. The text is written by Kevin Dooley, so it's freaking hysterical. I mean, it's really, really funny. I don't know that all of MangaCon's history had ever been revealed until here. And half of it, you read it, and you're like, I don't even know if I should believe that. It's so ridiculous. For example, they talk about this whole culture of bartering. Says they flew by Earth in 1626 and witnessed the purchase of Manhattan for a few beads and trinkets, and so therefore the race dedicated themselves to trading. I imagine Kevin Dooley just made that up for this entry, but it's freaking hysterical. It's wonderful. I love it. You definitely should check it out. We'll put this on the website. I'll also include the backside so you can read the funny jokes. The inset picture has Elrond, a close-up of his face. It's got the cluster spaceship, and it's got Guy Gardner yelling at Elrond. The whole idea, and when they were introduced in Justice League International, it was a slow build-up. So at first you thought it was going to be like a Galactus-level threat. They even really played it to look like Galactus with the cluster ship and all this, and the threat to Earth. And then you find out literally it's a joke about the Home Shopping Network, which was hysterical. And people don't get the joke really. They're not really funny, and they're kind of dead inside. So you should like this. They do talk about in here on how his parents swap MangaCon for a copy of Binky number 1. Come on, that's good.
I did like that. That's good. Yeah.
Okay. And of course, I flipped the page and I found out I had more notes. Elrond, they talk about how Elrond's now a member of the JLA. And MegaCon has a school for melodramatic shouting, which is beautiful. And they also talk about how he's actually a gaseous creature inside of a suit. People forget that because he's always walking around in his suit. And here it is, folks. Arlene Lowe, you have been banned until this moment. Under Powers and Weapons, ladies and gentlemen, it says, possessing advanced smarts and no weapons, Elrond, it should say MangaCon there, is more or less a pacifist trained in many techniques of running away.
Oops.
Very, very disappointing, Arlene. Someone at home, go ahead and no prize this. Try and figure out a way that I'm wrong. But yeah, we were doing good up until that.
I think it's interesting that Elrond gets all the insets to himself.
Well, it's because Elrond actually joined the Justice League at this point. That's why. Just recently, in issue, I think it was 42, which would have been just a month or two ago, Elrond stayed on Earth and has become Maxwell Lord's sort of assistant. He really kind of supplanted Oberon quite a bit. So he became a very important character. So, and MangaCon at this point was appearing in Mr. Miracle literally at this time. So that's why Joe Phillips is drawing it. And first appearance is Justice League International number 14, June 1988.
Next up is Mr. Nebula and Scarlet Skeer from Justice League America, number 36. Both of them first appeared in Justice League America, number 36. They are Mr. Nebula is an interplanetary designer, and the Scarlet Skeer is is the locator for Mr. Nebula. So they're kind of a team. I mean, I imagine you love these characters, Jack.
To some extent, in extremely small doses. Just you want me to do this one?
Yeah, I do. I can't.
Okay.
All right.
These are Giffen and DeMatteis way leaning into the skid with humor. Okay, so do not even for a second take these guys seriously. Their primary adversary is Nort. Okay, so that's you got to frame your reference around that. When you think about how goofy these guys are, you got to go, okay, wait, they fight Nort. Okay, I get it now. They are without a doubt pastiches of Galactus and Silver Surfer. That is the point. Mr. Nebula is like Galactus, except he's an intergalactic, basically interior decorator, and Scarlet Skeer is obviously Silver Surfer, and that's it's totally goofy. It's the gags are over the top. I just don't give a damn how stupid they are. I love them. They're just fun. You know, they had appeared the previous year. They did not get many appearances, thankfully. I think even Giffen and DeMatteis knew that they were going a little, you know, this will work a little bit, but not a lot, thankfully. They even make reference to how they went to the school of, MangaCon's shouting kind of stuff. Anyway, written by Kevin Dooley, of course, because he was the editor on Justice League at the time. First appearance, as you said, was very, very recent, Justice League, America number 36. And borders are black for villains. And again, it was Tom Artis, by the way, who did the art on this. And I didn't look up where Tom Artis connected. I don't think he drew any Justice League issues, but certainly he did a great job sort of capturing the JLI sort of look of it, the very cartoony sort of fun style. So it's fun, guys. I feel like I'm apologizing for it too much. Just enjoy it. Go with it. That's what you got to do.
Yes. I was saying the listing leans really hard on the humor. I mean, really hard on the humor. So.
And let me ask you, Rob, would you rather talk about this one or the next one? I mean, come on.
Well, the next one is Northwind. It's all very exciting, especially him in his new costume. So next up is Injustice League.
Whoop, whoop.
First appeared in Justice League International number 23. Boy, I mean, didn't we already do the JLI themed issue? And we seem to be doing a lot of that here.
There's never enough of it.
My goodness. Drawn by Mike McCone, doing quite a nice job. And it's, again, it's basically your team of utter morts, Major Disaster, Blockbuster, Clock King, Multi-Man, and Clue Master. We've got them a nice close-up of them.
Oh, yeah, forgot one.
Oh, who's the – I forget what's
– The Mighty Bruce.
The Mighty Bruce. Okay. Sometimes they try too hard. On the back page, you've got the inset, and it's a close up of all their heads. I think they're slightly doing it. You want to make something of it?
Oh, they absolutely
kind
are.
Of look, and then on the back, on the very bottom, is sort of a lineup shot, even though they're in front of a bunch of prison bars. I will say, my little personal history with this team is, of course, I partly inked one panel for a comic book that this team appeared in. So Major Disaster is the character that appeared in the panel that I inked on. So that's my connection to the Injustice.
Spoilers for the JLI show, but yeah, I'm so excited by this entry. It's Mike McCone really was a great successor or fill-in artist, if you will, when Kevin Maguire wasn't around. Mike McCone sort of cut his teeth on some of the early JLI issues. This front page where they're standing, this is actually a lineup page where you can see the lines along the wall for height and everything. It's absolutely adorable. I mean, Multi-Man is crying and Clue Master is holding the ball and chain, and Big Sur is sort of holding it like a basketball. It's absolutely hysterical. I love this thing so very much. And if you read the entry, it's hysterical. I don't know if you took the time to actually read it, but they go in and the writer, who's Kevin Dooley, actually like describes them. He goes, "That's them. What? You want to know more? Sigh. All right." And then he gives you more. And he's like, "Still not satisfied? Okay, okay." And he's like, "What? There's more? You want to know their individual first appearances? Go buy the back issues. Give me a break." Which is, I mean, it cracks me up as I'm reading through this thing. So Kevin Dooley did a really nice job on this. The best line here is at the end, though, where it gets very meta. And he says, talking about how much of a losers they are. And he goes, "And it's doubtful any of them will appear in Batman movie sequels," which is absolutely awesome. Absolutely awesome. All right. So border is black, of course, for villain team. Right at this point, Justice League America was on issue 57. And it had been about 18 months since that Justice League Antarctica issue that Rob has already revealed. So for more on them, you could go to, I don't know, the JLI podcast.
Oh, God, I read enough already. Jeez.
Well, when we do the MASH themed Who's Who issue, you can talk about that a lot, all right?
Oh, that I would kill for their Who's Who in MASH comic.
And here's another person in scrubs. Okay, next.
Yeah.
All right, next entry. This is what you've been waiting for, folks. Justice League of America by Adam Hughes and Carl Story. It's the cover entry. Now, this is a little bit different than the cover. The cover entry had this team shot, and in the background on the monitor, it said Justice League of America. Here on the background monitor, you see the Justice League Europe, folks. But it's a great shot in the foreground. You've got Martian Manhunter smiling. You've got Maxwell Lord smiling. They're both kind of on each side. You've got, in the very foreground, Ice is forcing Guy Gardner to smile. She's actually forcing the corners of his mouth up to smile, which is adorable. And the main, the money shot, if you will, is Booster and Beetle holding up Fire, who's just like, you know, having a blast because she's the center of attention. And of course, that's what Fire wants to be, is the center of attention. And you have Elrond sort of on the side waving as well. This screams fun. This screams bwahaha. This screams, you know, why can't we have fun comics? You know, we've got the 5YL on the page before, which is all dark and gritty. Here's a way to have fun with your comics, folks. And again, in the background, the surprint, Justice League Europe, you get Captain Atom, you get Catherine Colbert. Oh, my heart throbbed, Catherine Colbert. Crimson Fox, Flash, who's sort of mugging there with Power Girl, who's probably disgusted by him. You got Elongated Man and Rocket Red. So what do you think of this piece, buddy?
I like it a lot. I think it's great. I mean, again, it's Adam Hughes and stuff. I wish the colors were like a little more vibrant, like that background is just kind of this dull grayish thing. I wish it had been just a little more primary. But I like all the characters. I like the way they interact. I like the the tones that Hughes puts on, like Maxwell Lord's jacket and Elrond's robot body. It's got like a little bit of a duotint. And it's I like the thing with ice and fire. And I love the insets on the back. The insets on the backs are phenomenal.
Yes, the top one, you've got all the teams sitting there, they're goofing around, like fire sticking out her tongue. Beetle's got on Groucho Marx glasses, and Booster's got a sign that says, "I'm stupid." And it looks like probably Max is giving them a lecture, and they're just bored out of their mind. And the bottom one is a tribute to the old Justice League. You've got like Black Canary, you've got Hawkman in the shadows in the background. And I don't know, I wonder if that's sort of a hint about, you know, Hawkworld, how he's removed now from continuity, at least at this point. Then you've got Green Arrow with, is that without his beard, it looks like? I think so. Marsha, everyone's very shadowy in the bottom one because it's sort of a tribute to what's happened before, because you've got Gypsy there. So there's your nod to Justice League Detroit. You've got Batman in the shadows. You've also got, you know, but Mr. Miracle, who's a more recent character. It's really nice. Yeah, right. It's well put together. If you showed me that bottom one and told me it was Adam Hughes, I probably wouldn't believe you.
It looks like an exhibit at the Space Museum.
Okay. Yeah, I'll give you that. Yeah.
Yeah, I really – these both insets are great. I really love that one of the classic JLA. I just think they look suitably iconic.
Yeah.
Really neat.
Well, of course you love that. I mean, come on. Then you get into the entry itself. It doesn't spend much time talking about the classic JLA. It really dives pretty quickly into the legend story and how the Justice League International was formed. They go through that whole process talking about how, of course, the foundation, how it was formed, Maxwell Lord, the international status, you know, the Justice League and Justice League Europe, that kind of stuff. So it all lays it out very nicely. I'm not going to go through it too deeply because, I mean, folks, just go listen to the Justice League International podcast. It's all there every month for you. It is written by Mark Waid. I was kind of surprised Kevin Dooley didn't step in as the editor at that point to want to write it, but Mark Waid wrote the entry. And, of course, first appearance. Now, this is Justice League America, or Justice League International, whichever way you want to call it. They say first appearance is Legends number 6, which, of course, is 1987, not that long ago. And, you know, I'm sort of surprised General Glory didn't make it into this entry because he premiered with the team 2 issues before this. Maybe he was a little too recent to end up in there, but General Glory did become a big part of the series at this point. And I think when we get to these issues, because like some people sort of roll their eyes when they hear about General Glory. They're like, oh, it was too silly. But really, some of those stories are really good with the General. And it's a playoff of Captain America on purpose to tell sort of a story about it. And I think a lot of people are going to be surprised when we get to those issues. Interesting fact, inker Carl Story used to shop at the comic book shop I worked at.
It's the year 1992, and the Justice Society of America, the world's first superhero team, make a triumphant return after 6 years trapped in another dimension. Finally home, the JSA find themselves relics in a world that has moved on. It's the age of pulse-pounding action, where the rules of fair play are tossed aside for gritty violence. Our heroes ask themselves, does the world still need a Justice Society? Oh, yes, it does. Join me, the Irredeemable Shag, for JSA in the 90s. We'll delve into the 10-issue Justice Society of America ongoing series, drawn by the iconic Mike Parabek. We'll explore the 8-issue retroactive miniseries and unearth hidden gems from the era. Join us for JSA in the 90s, available as part of the Justice Society Presents podcast feed, beginning in August 2024. All right, folks, we are back from the past. This is Shag and Rob from 2024. And if you're listening to this a few years from now, then I guess we're still in the past. I don't know. Whatever. Anyway, it is now time for Zoom's Who. Zoom, you can always addendum to the definitive directory of the DC Universe. And to be fair, this time, it is Zoom's template. However, all the work this time was done entirely by his son, Isamu Yukinori. He pulled together the artwork. He wrote the text. It is amazing. And folks, if you go over to our gallery, you can see the most glorious image of Justice League Europe. Okay, it is all artwork done by Bart Sears, with some of the inking was by Pablo Marcos and Randy Elliott. And what Isamu has done is he pulled a collage together of various panels from Justice League Europe books, from commissions that Bart Sears did that he found on the internet,
and he's created a singular image that I would never know in a million years is not a legitimate Who's Who entry. It is shocking. I'm going to describe it real quick, and then Rob and I can talk about it. So you got the whole team. Everybody's there. They're all facing forward. They're kind of in it. They're not looking up in a Kevin McGuire style, but they are sort of tiered, kind of up in that sort of fashion. You've got, in the very front, you've got Catherine Colbert looking at her JLI communicator. You've got Crimson Fox, and you've got Power Girl, and Wally Flash is kind of like creeping up on her. You got Silver Surfers and Blue Jay there. You got Captain Atom looking over his shoulder being like, hey, what the hell is Wonder Woman doing here? And Wonder Woman looks very unhappy to be there because, I mean, she probably got pulled in for this reunion photo after being part of the team for 9 panels. Then you've got Animal Man is smiling at the crowd. You've got Metamorpho sort of being grumpy. You've got a huge, huge Rocket Red in the background, which looks phenomenal. And you've got Elongated Man sticking his head up. And you've got the Justice League Europe logo in the top left-hand corner. And then you've got the skyline, like a silhouetted skyline of London. I got lots to say, but what do you think, buddy?
Okay, well, before we even get to this, I have one comment I need to make that I didn't get a chance to say because you were busy berating the audience. Considering how I know how you feel about Dr. Fate, I think it took enormous personal courage to leave Dr. Fate out of this clip package, right? We all know how you feel about that. I mean, I love Dr. Fate. The whole network loves Dr. Fate, but you have a very special connection to Dr. Fate. And so the fact that you left him out, I think, says a lot about you.
Well, I appreciate you with that follow-up comment 2 hours and 20 minutes after we talked about it.
Exactly. Well, I said you didn't let me get a word ahead, but you were busy yelling at the audience for complaining before they complain. So, okay, I have two observations about this piece. First of all, I have seen movie posters put out by giant movie studios that don't look as cohesively put together as this entry.
Oh, wow. Wow. Right?
I have seen movie posters where they've clearly, you know, oh, good. We got, you know, whatever actor you want to think of. We got Brad Pitt and we had this other actress, but they were never in the same room. So let's stitch it together.
Mm-hmm.
Those look worse. Some of those have looked worse than what I see that Isamu did. I mean, it wasn't until you showed it to me and told me that he collaged this. I thought, well, this must be a piece that Bart did somewhere. And he, you know, Isamu was using it, right? It was like a full piece. No, it's stitched together. I can't believe it. I just can't believe that he did that.
He shared a behind the scenes photo with us. And that's not my place to share it. If Isamu shares it on social media, that's his choice. But it was basically an in progress. And Rob and I could see literally the stitching together of every piece and how he would take an image and then he would put a layer on top of it and trace the parts he needed to, but then maybe change the direction of the eyes or change the direction of an expression or whatever to make it, as you said, be so cohesive. I mean, this is amazing. Like, I know when this starts to get to the wider internet, everyone's going to ask Bart when he drew this commission piece, you know, and I feel like I almost need to give Bart a heads up so that he's not like, you know, caught off guard going, what is this thing?
It'll be like, when his father did the Superman and Wonder Woman listings for the first volume and people were like, wait, what issue of Who's Who was that?
Yeah,
I don't have that one. It'll be totally that. So my other observation related to Isamu and Zoom is I am not convinced, and you will never convince me, that Zoom did not upload his consciousness into a computer and he is like Jor-El-ing it in the Fortress of Solitude to Isamu. First of all, that would be wonderful if he did. But I just don't believe it. Not to slight Isamu's work in the slightest, but the fact that these Who's Who entries just keep rolling along, I really think that Isamu comes home and puts a crystal in a little thing and boom, there's Zoom relating, you know, Trees by Joyce Kilmer. It's just unbelievable.
Oh my gosh. Oh, that is too damn funny. Well, you know, it's interesting because most of the other Who's Who entries that Isamu, I don't know if it's Isamu or Isamu, actually, I don't know. So I apologize, our friend, our adopted nephew. But a lot of the other entries his dad did have a hand in, you know, whether it was the writing the text or starting to lay it out or whatever. This one is all Isamu, right? I mean, he did this entirely himself. He and I were messaging back and forth about what JLI related entries were missing. I mentioned this one and then boom, this thing shows up in my inbox. Unbelievable. We should talk about the back too, by the way. So in the true loosely fashion, it's got the border red for Hero Team. It's got, you know, Justice League Europe. It talks about London being the headquarters at this point, gives the first appearance. And it has an even inset pictures. Like, it's got an inset team picture that I got to assume is another collage. I don't know. It's gorgeous. It looks absolutely legit. And then the little inset pictures, I actually recognize one or two of those from the comic. But the way he's done it and featured it here, they genuinely look like they were created for this entry.
It does. It's flawless.
Yeah, the first one is Catherine Colbert, like, touching her finger sort of flirtingly on Captain Adams' nose. The next one is Ralph and Sue being sweet to each other. And the last one is Inspector Camus, which is the Interpol agent, banging his head against the wall in frustration. And I genuinely recognize some of these from the books, but the way he has cropped them and used them and put them in here, they look like they were art created just for this, and it's stunning. It's amazing. The entry is, that Asamu wrote is great. I'm not going to read it for you word for word. You'll be able to see it on the website, but it's straight up the history of the JLE. You know, it tells you about how the invasion happens, and they form the extra team because there's too many members in the American team during the recruitment drive. Talks about all the characters. Talks about how Wonder Woman and Animal Man both leave pretty early on. How Crimson Fox joins the team, and Blue Jay and Silver Sorceress. And talks about them being in Paris and then moving to London, all that stuff, and Inspector Camus. And it, you know, one of the things that struck me as I read his entry, which, by the way, is very well done, is the Justice League Europe team composition never really changed that much. I mean, yeah, Wonder Woman came off, Animal Man came off, and Crimson Fox came in, and Blue Jay and Silver Sorceress joined, but it's not like the American team. The American team practically had a revolving door. I mean, they were changing members every, like, five issues. There were, like, huge changes. Europe stayed pretty consistent during the whole Giffen DeMatteis run. I never thought about it that way.
Can I tell you a story related to JLI and Bart Sears that I don't think I've ever told you?
Let me guess. It happened at the Kubert School.
It did. Of course it did. How else would I have a story? I don't hang out with Bart. Like, you know. No. So, I mean, this book came, well, not the JLE Europe came out while we were at school.
Yeah.
And we were, I think it was second year or third year. And it came, so it came out. And I didn't have Bart as a teacher. I had interacted with him here and there, but because he was friends with other instructors of mine. But anyway, I didn't have a teacher. But anyway, the issue comes out and all the guys are frustrated at the relative lack of skin in the new Power Girl costume. And they're like, what the hell is she wearing a costume up to her neck? What the hell is that about? And they were just kind of giving Bart some grief about that. You know, Power Girl is, of course, famously this ridiculously built character, even for superhero anatomy, ridiculously built. And yet you've given her a turtleneck. And so Bart finally got some sort of, not really, but like kind of mockingly disgusted that he grabbed the copy of one of the guys' issues and got out a Caucasian skin colored marker and colored in all the white parts of Power Girl's costume. So all of a sudden she looks like she's Red Sonja or something. And he was like, here, is that better? And so I don't remember who he did it for. I don't know if that person still has that copy, but it's the only one in existence that has sort of like the half nude Power Girl.
That is hilarious. No, you've never told us, or I was waiting to be able to tell you that, having listened to the 2 hours and 20 minutes of clips, you'd already told that story like 5 years ago, but you have not. That is fascinating and hilarious.
It was because it was white that the color bled onto the white. Like, if it was any other color, you wouldn't have been able to color over it and make it look like of, you know, Caucasian flesh tone, but it just happened to be white. So there you go.
That is so stinking funny. Wow. And I will say, you know, Bart's redesigned costume, I think it's sexier than the other one because it's like spray painted on. It's like super skin tight. So
well,
I don't
all
know.
Of his costumes are that, but that's true. Yes. Yeah.
But
yes.
But all the characters look great. You know, it's first of all, we've been talking mostly about Asamu's work and praising him for that. So now to talk about Bart's pencils and the inks on here, I love Catherine Colbert in the front with the JLI communicator. You know, she's, you know, like we are nowadays with smartphones, basically. And of course, Catherine Colbert is gorgeous because Bart doesn't know how to draw her any other way. She steals my heart every time. You know, Power Girl is front and center, and so is her chest. And Wally is like coming up over her. He's got his hand on her shoulder, like he's trying to whisper in her ear. And she's giving him those side eyes like, I will kill you, Wally, is what it looks like there. Crimson Fox is very much in the foreground, kind of a you know, sexy pose, which makes sense because that's what her character does. And she was the only character really that was came from the book originally. So having her front and center, I think, is great. I love the confused look on Captain Adam, not just because Wonder Woman's there, but also he never really had it together as team leader. I mean, there's once in a while he'd get it together, but for the most part, he was not the world's greatest leader. So I love that. And I love how happy Buddy looks, you know, Animal Man. He just looks, look how happy that face is. He hadn't felt that happy since before Grant Morrison started writing his book, I think. And of course, Ralph looks great with the stretching, and Silver Sorceress is kind of looking at Blue Jay going, really? You're still on the team? And Metamorpho is just very, you know, just sullen and unhappy. You know, he's in that mode. And then, of course, the size. Look at the size on Rocket Red. Isn't that amazing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You could cut paper with Metamorpho's brow there. That is...
So fantastic, amazing artwork by Bart Sears and his inkers then, again, Randy Elliott and Pablos Marcos. Amazing assembly by Osamu Yukinori. Great text on the back. Gorgeous package all the way around, folks. And again, that's over on our website, on our image gallery. And I have no doubt within the next couple of weeks, this is going to go all over the internet and people are going to be talking about it and confused how this, you know, where they, how this is missing from their binders. So... well, that's it, folks. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the JLI Podcast and the Who's Who Podcast. Now, come back next episode of the JLI Podcast when we finally cover the glorious miniseries formerly known as the Justice League. We'll be covering all six issues in one episode, and I'll have another guest host to help me cover the story. Who's it going to be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode.
And come back next episode of the Who's Who Podcast when we'll do another episode of Who's Who Review, where we randomly pick 13 entries from the original Who's Who and review. Visit them, covering them with fresh eyes.
Well, thanks for listening, everybody. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Rob, and you've been listening to the Who's Who Podcast.
And the JLI Podcast.
Want to make something of it?
Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC Who's Who. Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Fishwick and Arisia and Woody Winks.
Hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC Who's Who.